Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights, installing and servicing a wide range of commercial and residential Velux skylight products. You can find more information about their installation process and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
DCU is proud to sponsor this conversation from Boston Public Radio. More at dcu.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Washington Post financial columnist Michelle Singletary joins us on the dangers of the increasing popularity of buy now, pay later plans. She'll also weigh in on the consequences of the recently expired expanded child tax credit. Then we'll get your thoughts on how a whole host of bad news on the personal financial front is affecting you and your family.
Former President Trump was planning a press conference on the one-year anniversary of the Capitol riots until yesterday. We'll have CNN analyst Juliet Kayyem explain why it fell apart. Plus, tell us about that insane 24-hour black ice-caused traffic jam in Virginia and how it could have been handled better. All that and more ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. GBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. And here's hoping that the people Henry was just talking about in southern New Hampshire get to their destination quicker than the people in Virginia did yesterday.
Oh, 24 hours stuck on the highway. Can you imagine?
No, I'd deal with that quite well.
I think you would deal with it, right? You wouldn't be with us anymore, Jim, I don't think.
So if you've set a financial resolution for 2022, Michelle Singletary is here to help keep you on track and keep you informed of the upcoming changes that will affect your personal finances this year. She is a personal finance columnist for the Washington Post, where she writes the nationally syndicated Color of Money column. Her latest book is What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a survival guide. Michelle, Happy New Year. Great to talk to you.
Yes, Happy New Year to you too as well.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Michelle Singletary. So I remember talking to you at the beginning when we knew people were going to get this boosted child tax credit, and there was such excitement. Millions of children lifted out of poverty. Where are we now with the child tax credit, Michelle Singletary?
Well, at this point, the advance payments have ended. They ran from July to December, so that the families that qualified got half of the boosted payments and 6 monthly payments, or fewer months if they didn't apply to get them, or if they were sent in July. And so now, to get the second part of those boost up payments, they have to file a tax return this year for 2021, which when tax season opens up. There's still lots of debate about whether it will be in Biden's package. It looks like it's not going to be at this point, which is really just concerning to me, because we know that this extra money helped keep a lot of families, or boosted a lot of children out of poverty.
By the way, on that front, before you leave that, the number that I've read, correct me if I'm wrong, I may have read this in one of your columns too, is if everybody who was eligible had gotten it and applied for it, somewhere north of 40% of kids would have been raised out of poverty. And as it was, even with non-full sign up, 30% of kids who are in poverty rose out. Is that close to correct?
That is correct. Without the boosted tax credit, nearly 10 million children will fall deeper into poverty. And so we got the numbers. The Census Bureau has been tracking how people have been using the money. They were using it for exactly what it was intended to, feed their kids, keep a roof over their heads, buy clothes for them. And they managed them on a monthly basis. And it just made a huge difference for many of these families who are also still being impacted by the pandemic.
By the way, we should be clear of one more piece of news here. Even for those of you who are holding out hope, the so-called Build Back Better thing may still get 50 votes in the Senate and get to Joe Biden's desk, if obviously Kamala Harris would be the 51st vote. As you note in your piece, Joe Manchin, even if he votes for the A package, whatever it is, doesn't want this in, for a whole variety of reasons. He's buying into this whole notion that it discourages work, even though it's an additional whatever it is, you know, $100 a month, and the records are showing that most people are using it to do extravagant things like feed their family and pay their utility bills.
Exactly. I mean, there's no really credible evidence that when people get a hand up, they, like, I'm done. I'm never working again. You know, I mean, it is an addition to what they need to raise their families. And if they aren't going back to work, there's legitimate reasons why. You know, many people, and I know, I have three kids who I had to put in childcare to be able to work. It's extremely expensive. And they realize that minimum wage or just a little bit, if you know, over that, that they were working just to have their kids in daycare. And so they make the awful decision to say, well, you know, I'm just working to keep my kids away from me, right? Or it just wasn't enough, or they have long-term care issues. Maybe they're taking care of an elderly relative. And so you've got to put all of that in context. The way it is, you know, communicated is that there's this swath of Americans who just want to have their hands out and have the government give them money to do nothing. And that's just not true.
You know, I can't resist reading this quote from Joe Manchin that you included in your column, Michelle Singletary, when he says, when he's objecting to this child care tax, not child care tax credit, the child tax credit, there's no work requirement whatsoever, he says. There's no education requirements whatsoever for better skills. Don't you think if we're going to help the children that the people should make some effort? What a nasty
thing. That's clearly a man who's never worked with these people, you know, and you know, I don't want to demonize him. I'm sure somewhere in his mind.
Go ahead.
You could demonize him.
You know, somewhere in his head, he thinks he's making sense and speaking for them. But, you know, I actually work with these people he's talking about. And, you know, millions of kids are being raised by their grandparents. I was one of those kids. And so it's not that they're not working. They've already had a work life, and now they stepped in to take care of their grandchildren, which actually saves the, you know, the federal government money because they are stepping in to take care of these children. And so the idea that people don't want to work. Now, you know, there are always outliners. There's always people who do want to take advantage of the situation, but you don't create a policy for the outliners.
Exactly.
You don't do that. You look at the vast majority of families are going to be lifted up. And, you know, the education piece, these folks can't afford to send their, you know, their kids to school or to go back themselves. It's very expensive to go to college. And then they don't want to put money in the budget to help pay for college. So it's mind-numbing, you know, how, you know, they want people to do these things, but they don't want to put in place policies that will help them help themselves.
Well, by the way, all fairness, you criticized Joe Manchin. He has an experience. We know that he obviously was deeply involved in raising one of his kids, his daughter, who was the woman who raised the price of the EpiPen 600% so that the average person who needed it to save their own child's life couldn't afford it.
With peanut allergies.
Exactly.
Right.
So we're talking to Michelle Singletary. Can we stay on the bad news front for a couple of minutes and try to get it out of the way? The Fed is going to be raising in interest rates, and it's doing it theoretically to deal with inflation. But how does that trickle down or trickle up into our credit card rates, our adjustable mortgage rates, and all that kind of thing this year, Michelle Singletary?
Yeah, so, you know, the Fed sets a benchmark rate, and based on that, other rates can be adjusted up or down. And so when the Fed rate goes up, it impacts eventually variable mortgage rates and any debt that is variable, and that's credit card debt. You know, your interest rate can change. And if you've got a home equity line of credit, or, you know, that can change. If you've got a fixed rate, it won't change that. If you have an adjustable mortgage, it could impact that. And so, yes, going forward, the Fed has said, we're probably going to do this, so you better, you know, get ready. And so that means that if you are carrying credit card debt from month to month, that action is going to impact you. Now, the amount of money may not be, thousands of dollars, because we're talking, you know, very small increment increases in the rates. Nonetheless, over time, not paying off that debt and having to roll it over and pay, I mean, the average interest rate on a credit card is anywhere from 16 to 17%, and some people it's 20 to 30% if you've got, you know, a bad credit. And so I think this signals to people for 2022, because rates are going up, that if you have credit card debt, you need to make it a priority to get rid of that debt as best that you can.
Michelle Singletary, I've asked this question many times, and why not ask you too. We never hear about an effort to get down those credit card rates, which used to be, once upon a time, really pretty low, not 16, 17, 20%. Why doesn't Congress ever go after those?
Well, you know, everybody comes free market. That's what they say. That's what the market will bear. People are paying it, who has the lobbying dollars? It's not the average credit card holder. It's the banking institutions. And so, really, they dictate, policy. So you're absolutely right. Those rates are crazy, especially when you compare it to what people are getting when they deposit their money in the financial institutions, which is a pitiful amount right now if you've got a, savings account. And so really, those who have the dollars often dictate the policies.
Marjorie, you don't remember. You asked that question of Barney Frank one day years ago. Frank, who at the time was the chair of the Financial Services Committee in the House. And I believe his answer was exactly like Michelle's, is they could cap it, but there's not the political will because of where the power lies in Congress. And so, but people should be clear, Congress would have the power, correct, Michelle? They could cap these rates if they chose at whatever level they wanted.
They could, absolutely.
Yeah, they went up. They went up when interest rates went up through the roof back in the 70s, I think, or whenever the interest rates went through the roof, and then they never came back down. Right?
No, they never came back down. That's exactly right. And so, I encourage people, I use credit card, but I pay my bill off every month. I encourage people that if you have to charge something that you can't pay off the next month, then that's something that you probably shouldn't be buying. Now, we do know that in times of economic downturn that people turn to their credit cards when they go through their savings. They use it to buy groceries and do some things. And I understand that. And sometimes you do what you have to do. But if that's not you, and you're just still adding to that, you should be on notice that this debt is going to get, much more expensive and starting this year in 2022.
You said they go to their credit cards, or apparently, according to you and others, they go to these buy now, pay later plans. I have to say, I miss this phenomenon. My mother used to do buy now, pay later plans for like a piece of furniture or that sort of thing. And but there's a whole new phenomenon. Could you describe?
Well, she talks about two, which was around for a long time, was layaway, right? That your grandmother buys.
That's what it was. I mean, that's what they called it then, right?
Yeah, you pay little by little by little until you can pay the whole thing, and then you go to get it. I remember that when I was a kid. That was very, very common. But explain the buy now, pay later thing.
So it's a little it's sort of the modern version of a layaway plan. So my grandmother did the same thing. She only used it really just once a year around the holiday. She'd put some toys and clothes and stuff on layaway. So you'd put it, you give it to the merchant, get the merchandise, give it to the merchant. You didn't get to take it home. And then you made weekly payments until you paid it off and then you collected it. With buy now, pay later is that you get whatever you want now, and then you're going to pay for it later. It's really credit, right? It's just a way, and it does help some people who don't have a credit card or can't get a credit card. But the problem is that it's on a lot of items that you wouldn't necessarily need, makeup and clothes. I mean, that party dress that you maybe wore for New Year's Eve at a party you probably shouldn't have attended. And they're targeting young adults, so the things that they're buying are not necessarily necessities like that couch or that bed. And there's some concern that people will overspend. There's some concern that some of the programs, not all of them, some of them don't charge any fees. And so it really is, you pay. If you can't pay, they stop. You can't buy anything else. But some of them have fees. And now we're knowing that some of the credit card bureaus are going to say, we're going to start reporting whether you not make these payments on time. And so the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has said they're going to be looking at this trend to make sure that consumers are not being taken advantage of.
By the way, two things, Michelle Singletary. One, how what percentage of the population is using these things? I know it's primarily young people. And are they doing this rather than using a credit card because they don't have the credit history to qualify for a credit card?
Yeah, it's not as large as you would think. I mean, more people use credit cards than they do these. And they are definitely aimed at younger adults, people with who don't, say, have credit. And, you know, if you've been shopping this holiday season, you've probably seen it on almost anything that you were going to buy. I mean, like, I saw it. I was buying something for, I don't know, like $20. And it was like, you could, like, stretch this over four payments. It's like, really? And so, but it is a growing trend because people want what they want when they want it. And the thing about credit, it should give you a little bit of pause because of all this, you know, interest that's being charged. The thing about buy now, pay later is that you're not charged interest, but you could be charged fees. And then you be careful if you don't make the payments that can impact your ability to build a good credit history. And so I just, you know, the cautionary tale is for people to just be very careful. Think about, do I really need this? And if I got to stretch it over four payments, I probably can't afford it.
We're talking to Washington Post financial columnist Michelle Singletary. Her book is called The Color of Money Column, and her book is What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, a Survival Guide. So we just talked about these terrible fees that banks charge on credit cards, but it does seem like one bank is doing something good on overdraft fees, and why are they doing it?
Oh, yeah. How many of us, raise your hand if you hate overdraft fees?
Yeah.
So Capital One Bank said, you know what, we're doing away with these overdraft fees. And it's one of the largest banks that has stepped up to say, we're no longer going to do this. And I just want to applaud them for that decision and hope that other institutions follow lead. Because, you know, someone who, say, purchases something for $20 could end up with, you know, hundreds of dollars in overdraft fees as things, you know, trickle down. You know, you get hit with it, and then if something coming, you know, you make a check or you're trying to pay a bill, and it, you know, you get hit with that overdraft fee for all of them. And so Capital One, you know, because they recognized how onerous it was for so many people, decided to eliminate it. And I think that was a great move, and I'm really hoping that other major institutions follow their lead.
You know, by the way, Capital One does another great thing here beyond getting rid of the overdraft fee. They have a cafe in their bank, which, as far as I'm concerned,
they do?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I did not
get
know
a
that.
Cup of coffee in the bank. But, yeah, I don't really – they use a word that you emphasize in the statement from the company. They use the word, you know, make the something like making the banking community more humane.
Bringing humanity to banking. Yes.
But I don't understand. Other than saying we're doing this good thing and you're not, so hopefully people, particularly those who have a lot of overdraft problems, will maybe end up at that bank as opposed to the bank they currently use. What's the bottom line reason for this? I mean, I can't figure out anything other than trying to make themselves more attractive than another bank. Am I being too cynical?
I think it's a good move. I mean, you know, let's be real. They're giving out millions of dollars.
Yeah, exactly.
Banks love these fees, but the problem is they disproportionately impact low-income consumers and communities of color. And I think Capital One, you know, maybe it's a publicity stunt or not, but it's still a good thing and a right thing to do. Recognize that the people most impacted are the people who least can afford it. And that's not humane. That's not, you know, the right thing to do. You know, it's not as if the banks aren't making, you know, boatloads of money. And so I think, for whatever reason, I'm going to embrace that this is a good thing, and hopefully other, you know, banks will follow, particularly because we know who is harmed by it the most. And that when we talk about overdraft fees, I always get these emails and letters from people, well, you should just manage your money better. And, you know, I mean, it just – You know, listen, I'm all about personal responsibility. I've been on your show many times. I write about this. I work in my community. I'm training and helping people manage their money better. But you know what? Life happens, and people make mistakes. But should we hammer them once they've made a mistake, or do we help them do better? So denying a transaction that could, a $20 transaction that could cost them hundreds of dollars and send them spiraling down is the right thing to do, right? We've got to get out of, we in America like to wag our fingers at people.
We do.
You know, claiming that we, you know, do our lives better, you know, and I just think we need to give people grace. And that's not me holding them responsible. When I do my courses, I'm not like, you know, namby-pamby. I'm like, you shouldn't do this, but let me show you how to make better decisions. And I think Citibank is saying, listen, if we deny these transactions, it's going to help people or force them to be better with their banking rather than recognizing, which the other institutions do, people are going to mess up, they're going to overdraft, and let's profit from that. And that's where I have a problem.
Can I just say, I can pay you a compliment, if I may. One of the reasons why you are, I think, so effective as a columnist, I am one, Marjorie knows this, I don't like telling people where I had lunch yesterday.
Yeah.
You bake into your columns when you've had personal experience. In this overdraft thing, you talk about the problems your brother, your late brother,
yes,
had, who had epilepsy.
Yes.
And I have to say, it makes it, and you know this, so much more real and so much more accessible. And it's a hard thing to do, and I really give you a lot of credit, Michelle Singletary, for willingness to open up your life to make the lives of those around you better than they are. You really, it's quite a talent.
Yeah,
well,
thank
well,
you. I appreciate
well, we're
that.
On
I've
the...
had a hard life, and I just, I feel like, you know, I was rescued. My grandmother rescued me from mm-hmm. a really bad situation. And, you know, the moment I graduated from college, I had to, she turned over the care of my disabled brother to me. I was 21, and I became his caregiver, financial and physical and emotional. And I saw how hard my brother, I saw how hard he tried, you know,
yeah,
to make a living for himself. He did not want a handout.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember him taking a job that required like two buses and then for him to walk a mile to the job. And I said, honey, you can't, that's just going to be too much on you, you know. And he had to be there at, you know, like the crack of dawn. So he had to get on a bus at 3 or 4 in the morning. And, you know, he had a massive seizure at work and he lost that job after a couple months. And I just thought, so when people talk about people not wanting to work in handouts and, you know, overdraft and they're being irresponsible, you know, my brother did the best he could, but he did overdraft sometimes because he's trying to make it on the little money that he was making. And so, you know, I had to rescue him from the situation where he was, you know, overdrafted, and I had to go into the bank and talk to them and explain what was going on. And, you know, I had to sort of, you know, take away his ATM card, you know, and just sort of help him manage because he just couldn't on his own. And so I, you know, I've been in a situation where I didn't have any money. I'm, you know, being taken care of by somebody else, then being a caregiver for someone else who's living on the edge. And so I just want to communicate to people who are making the policies, who are so quick to criticize people who make mistakes and fall down or not where they are in life. And at the same time, also teaching people to be more responsible. You know, I worked with my brother to become more, you know, with he ended up getting Social Security disability
mm-hmm.
to live within that money, as little as it was. And my husband and I supplemented him and helped him. So I have the sensibility because I know where those people have walked because I've walked that path. And now that I'm doing better, I don't want to lose that perspective. And I think that's what happens. People who end up doing better for themselves lose the perspective of what it's like to struggle and how when you're struggling, it is very difficult to make sound decisions because you're always in crisis mode, right? And so that's why I try to, you know, use my life stories to say, let's have compassion while we're creating policies, hold people responsible, but also realize that they're going to fail. And when they fail, there has to be a safety net to help lift them up.
Well, you do it beautifully, Michelle Singletary. It's great to talk to you as always. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your great cause, Michelle, and thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate you guys having me.
Thanks. Michelle Singletary is a nationally syndicated columnist for The Washington Post. Her award-winning column, The Color of Money, provides insight into the world of personal finance. You can see it in the Boston Globe. Her latest book is What to Do with Your Money When Crisis Hits, A Survival Guide. So coming up, we're going to talk a little bit about what we talked about with Michelle Singletary. Open the lines up, 877-301-8970, BPR at WGBH.org, to get your take on the financial situations that impact you, from interest rates rising to the end of the expanded child tax credit. How about these kids, which most of the kids, as you said, young people, buying today and paying tomorrow? You seeing that in your own family? All those fancy New Year's Eve dresses, where did they come from? Of course, I'd assume you even went to a New Year's Eve party this year. Is any of this working for you? Are you worried about it? That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Even as the pandemic continues to affect our daily lives, some protections meant to keep Americans afloat, financially at least, are expiring, as we just discussed with Michelle. The expanded child tax credit, lauded as this vital tool to bring children out of poverty, and it did, has reverted back to pre-pandemic levels. The feds are raising interest rates, as we just discussed, which may inform your New Year's resolution to pay down that debt as soon as possible. And as we just discussed, the buy now, pay later industry is on notice by federal regulators for encouraging overspending, particularly by younger consumers. So have you fallen prey to buy now, pay later ads when perusing the racks online and purchase something you might not have otherwise? Are you worried about even higher credit card interest rates when the Fed raises interest rates? And are you affected by the evaporating expansion of the child tax credit? Boy, this is an upbeat topic. We'd like to hear from you at 877-301-8970. You can tweet us at BOS Public Radio or email us at bprwgbh.org. Think about this for a minute. We just lived through a year through when this pathetic Congress actually did something, at least early in the year, to provide a lifeline to people and businesses that were suffering. And we enter the next year with the case numbers at least twice as high as they ever were, meaning the number of daily infections that are reported at least twice as high. They're allowing the child tax credit to go back to its pre-pandemic levels. And by the way, what that means, if it wasn't clear, you weren't listening to Michelle. One, no more monthly checks. And that's if you're really low income, so low income you don't pay taxes, you don't get it anymore. The Fed's going to raise interest rates because of inflation, which means your credit card rates and your adjustable mortgage payments are going to go up. I mean, buy now, pay later, apparently. What are the 20% of young people or 20% of America?
Yeah, Americans in the last year, they've used the buy now, pay later credit, which if you're going to make your payments on time, can work for you, even though you may spend it on things you don't need. But if you don't pay on time, then you get hit with these fees.
Yeah, but I mean, come on. That's like saying if you pay off your whole credit card every month, you don't pay the interest. Obviously, we wouldn't have credit cards if people didn't violate that notion and not pay it off every month. So they were paying boatloads of interest to these companies.
You know, there's also this other question that I love that she puts in her column.
What's that?
You know, why is it that when you're talking about helping working people who are poor or people who aren't working at all, there's always this Joe Manchin thing that they're going to scam the system, even though we learned from the reporting on this child tax credit that the vast majority of people were using it on necessities like food and rent? Why is there always that admonition? But when rich people want to keep their estate tax break, or when Donald Trump says, you know, he works the system, that's why he doesn't pay any taxes, or when billionaires don't pay their fair share, we talk endlessly about how, you know, Amazon is and Jeff Bezos are not paying their fair share. Why is that? What is it? Why do we think that poor people are scamming the system, but rich people who admit they scam the system, it's okay for them to scam the system? I'm not sure. Jim, what do you think?
Well, the answer to the question is I have no idea, but I don't like it either. 877-301-8970.
They're buying food with the child tax credit, most of them. You see the picture of Jeff Bezos on his yacht with that ridiculous shirt on. Did you see the shirt he had on?
No.
I guess he's been working out 24/7 because he looks like Mr. Abs with his shirt and his girlfriend.
It's amazing his time to do
massive,
that.
Yeah, yeah, it's just incredible. We don't seem to resent them the way we resent single moms, I guess.
So we want to know how you're reacting to the changing financial realities. Congress is not helping. Maybe someday a piece of this Build Back Better will happen. Maybe the state legislature, now that they finally return from their almost 2 month Christmas vacation, will do something as well. But at least on these fronts, this means less money in the pocket of the average American as this Omicron thing is raging across America. So tell us, one, how it's affecting you, and two, how you're dealing with it. Let's start with Jasmine. You're in Somerville. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. First of all, longtime listener.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Caller.
Thanks.
Yeah. So you were talking earlier about the, like, buy first, pay later.
Yes.
Millennials are doing. I'm a millennial who fell into that trap. I'm currently sitting on a $2,000, maybe $2,500 Peloton.
You were the call we were dreaming we would get. Go ahead,
okay.
Jasmine.
Yeah. And it's not even one of the new ones. The screen is, like, pretty static. But, yeah, it was. I got it at the beginning of the pandemic, and I got it through this program where it's interest-free, but the Peloton itself costs $55 a month, plus the $39 that I need to actually use it. And what? it just keeps going. It just keeps going out of my account. It forces me to use it, like, whenever the payment comes out of my account, and I'm like, oh my God.
Forces me.
Okay, Jasmine, how many years before you've paid for this Peloton?
Maybe like 3 years. So I'm a year in. I think I have another 3 years to go.
So why'd you do it, Jasmine? Looking back, why'd you do it?
Think about the shape she's going to be in because she's at the end of 3 years, because you're going to use it, right, to justify the spending. So you're going to be, like, spectacular.
Why'd you do it?
I will say my fitness has moderately improved.
Good.
Since I got it. Why did I do it? Because I felt like kind of, you know, beginning of the pandemic, overeating, staring at CNN. And I was like, let me get a Peloton so I can stare at a different screen and exercise. And I did it once at, you know, someone's house. And I was like, this is a great purchase. And here it is. It takes up a lot of room.
Hey, Jasmine, before you go,
knowing
what you know now and experiencing what you've experienced since you bought it, would you do it again?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, okay. Well, then
hey,
you got
one last thing, Jasmine. You mentioned it's $55 a month to pay for it. The $39 a month is for the different programs, the different classes?
Yeah. So the, like, 50-something bucks is for the actual bike, and then I need – and then it's like $39 to pay for the actual programs. I will say, actually, I would not buy the bike again. I would buy the app. The $39 app is absolutely worth it.
Okay.
Jasmine, wish you luck. You're an honest person. Thanks so much for the call. 877-301-8970.
What I mostly know is people buying stuff, the buy now, pay later thing. Clothes. They buy clothes that way, you know. People used to do that rent a runway and they still do, where you rent a dress for some fancy occasion, but clothes is where I've heard a lot of people spending.
Well, I know some people who shall be remain unnamed who buy things, wear them once, and then return them and say that they're – I'm not advocating that, by the way. I don't think that's a terribly moral approach to whatever. But, you know what's incredible, by the way? I don't want to rail about this because I know it's a tired subject. There's so many simple things when we're listing these financial woes that are being visited on virtually every American except the top 1% or whatever that Congress could do, including your favorite, capping credit card rates or more seriously regulating this buy now, pay later. And they don't give a damn. I mean, they don't give a damn, and almost everybody's going to get reelected, and it's really a mess.
Well, you know, I mentioned yesterday, remember speaking of January 6th, as we were earlier, all these corporations who said they were going to take a pause on their contributions to political candidates, particularly those who had denied the reality of the election.
Mm-hmm.
Front page story yesterday about Raytheon.
Yeah.
Right back giving that money.
I wonder why that is.
Well, I think because they want their agenda.
Defense contracts.
Exactly, in Congress. And so, as we know, money in politics has corrupted the system. Mohammed in Providence, thank you for calling.
Hey, Mohammed.
Hey, how we doing, everybody?
We're good. Thank you for calling.
All right. So I just want to address Marjorie's question. She talked about why do the middle class really rebel against things that help them. the Joe Manchins of this world.
Yeah.
Why is he not helping West Virginia? And I read somewhere once, in Alabama before integration, everybody had free swimming pools, free this and free that. And once they integrated, everybody all of a sudden was against any social services, because the idea is if you help the minorities, they'll rather not take it if it's going to help anybody that doesn't look like them, even though they benefited from all those programs prior to integration. And I think that's a real factor where people would rather see this whole thing go to waste than have the other have a piece of it.
You speak about racism, Mohammed.
It's almost what we're talking about right now in politics. I mean, if you look at some of the services, you just spoke of, child tax credit. What American doesn't need help, taking care of kids? But, for some reason, if it's viewed as, if these foreigners are going to use, the black people are going to get some of that help. Oh, forget it. We're not going to help them, even though it's going to hurt us. So I think it's Alabama, Mississippi, all those southern states used to have public swimming pools.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, we're not going to fund those. We're not going to fund high schools. So I think it's all rooted in some kind of bigotry.
Well, I think you may have a
right.
point there, Mohammed. I mean, when was it Reagan that talked about welfare queens?
Oh, yeah.
Who was he talking about?
Well, that's true. And by the way, he almost sunk. I used to, I worked in legal services in the South Bronx, ran the legal
right.
services union. He almost sunk the whole program talking about exactly. He picked one case in Connecticut and he blew it up. And again, to use a word that Michelle used, it was an outlier. It was not a typical thing.
Right.
But it was a welfare queen case, to use that horrible expression that you were referencing a minute ago. And it was so effective that it literally almost brought down a program that provided free legal services in civil cases to tens of millions of Americans.
You know what's interesting about Reagan? I think a lot of Republicans think of him, and moderate Republicans think of him as sort of, a great president. When you look at all our financial woes in this country now, including increasing income inequality and including the sense of the government not doing things like infrastructure, et cetera, where did that begin? With him,
yeah.
right? Trickle-down economics and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I think the history books are going to look at his impact, not favorably, but very disfavorably.
Well, except there's one class of mostly poor people who he did something for, as compared to Joe Biden's predecessor, is on the immigration front.
That's a very good point.
A major called amnesty by a lot of critics
yep.
in those days. He had the courage to do that, which... Catherine in Fall River. Boy, this is depressing. Catherine in Fall River, lift our spirits. How are you?
Hi, Catherine.
Hi, I'm doing well, thank you. How are you guys?
Great,
fine,
thanks for calling.
Sure. So I just wanted to go back to, I just got in the car, so I didn't hear the whole conversation you guys were having, but I heard Marjorie say something about, why do we give Jeff Bezos so much leeway when we don't give that same leeway to single parents or
yep.
people who require the assistance in? I think it's because most people, unfortunately, see themselves more capable of reaching a Jeff Bezos level of success than they do struggling in the way that a single mother would. Or it's this idea of, if you're poor, it's your own fault for not working harder. And look how hard Bezos worked, so he deserves it.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with that, but I think that's kind of where people's minds are.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And, of course, the irony is that a lot of people who are poor or working poor are working two and three jobs, right, Catherine, to pay the bill. So they're working pretty damn hard. That's a great point.
Well, also, a variation of what you're saying in a prior caller said, Catherine, the brilliance, and thank you for your call, the brilliance of some elected officials and lobbyists for people at the top is they pit working class people against working class people in different sorts of ways. So while they're fighting with each other, people who don't need the largesse of the government end up walking away with most of it. I mean, that thing, did you mention this, or Michelle? You did mention this. I mean, the estate tax people aren't going crazy. That is what guarantees intergenerational
right.
income and wealth disparities in this country. And nobody's complaining about that. Paul in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Happy New Year, Marjorie and Jim. Carpe
Same to you,
team.
Paul.
To you too, Paul. Thanks for calling.
I want to share something with you, and I've got a tip that I think will help a lot of people. My son, who got married this summer, you remember that?
Sure.
Yes.
He's buying a house.
Good for him.
He's getting an offer on a house. So the younger generation is moving ahead and doing well. My kids are phenomenal at saving and doing great things with money for themselves. But one thing I worked with my daughter on when she wanted to get, she was using her debit card a lot and she didn't have any real credit built up, but she wanted to. And so I said, well, just get a credit card with, you know, a short, small balance allowed and pay it off like a debit card. So you use it, you're on your phone all the time anyway, press your banking app and just pay it right off right then while you're sitting at the table at the restaurant even. And you get points. She gets points on her credit card. She built. She got a 780 credit score. She's 22.
Wow.
You know, how can you beat that? Yeah.
So she builds up her credit by paying it off so quickly every single month.
And just using it in general, you know, having a credit card stuff off it. So she does the whole cycle, but she never has a balance on her credit card because she treats it like a debit card. And every once in a while, she gets, you know, $20-$30 worth of points in cash.
Yeah, but Paul, and by the way, well, that's admirable, and I wish everybody could and would do it. You know, the problem is that people, a ton of people, use credit cards not, but primarily for essentials in life, and don't have the luxury of being able to do that kind of paying off kind of thing. And one of the reasons they don't, we didn't get to discuss this with Michelle, is a lot of lower income people, in particular young people who are not so lower income, just pay the minimum. And as I think most people know, if you pay the minimum that the credit card company asks, more often than not, you end up paying more in interest once you've extinguished your debt than the underlying cost of the thing you bought to begin with. So if people are in a position where they can do what your kid did, I think it's fabulous. The problem is people most at risk financially can't do it. Paul, Happy New Year, though. Thank you so much for your call. 877-301-8970. You know, I am so out of my mind. Let's take a break and we come back.
Jim. I'm sorry you're depressed. We'll try to cheer you up.
Well, I'm going to say it right now. I mean, think about this thing for a second.
What?
There is proof of what this child tax credit has done for people in poverty in this country. And your favorite guy, one man, is standing in the way of it continuing for tens of millions of families in this country.
We're going down the tubes, Jim, but we have to try to be upbeat about it.
Okay, fine. No, that was as upbeat as I can get.
Okay. We're talking about a host of financial policies that are changing and how it impacts you, from interest rates going up to the buy now, pay later thing, to one really good thing, at least bank is getting, they're getting rid of the late fees.
Capital One, yeah.
At Capital One. So I think that's really exciting to those of us who've found ourselves paying hundreds of dollars in late fees.
Overdraft fees.
That's right. Overdraft fees. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Number's 877-301-8970, bprwgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And Marjorie's engaged this morning in basically depressing all of New England. We'd like you to call and contribute to that by calling 877-301-8970. What were you going to say?
I just got an email from Jay who says, in reality, on average, debt is down right now and savings are up for Americans. So he says we're missing the actual story here, and that people have, and that is true, people have saved considerable money during the pandemic, haven't they?
Well, I mean, and why have they saved considerable money?
Because they can't do anything or go anywhere.
Exactly, because you're shut in your house or your apartment. I mean, the reality, back to that emailer, is the reality is, as I said, what a difference a year makes. The number of infections have doubled, yet the number of the amount of support from the government is going in the exact opposite direction. Child tax credit expanded for 6 months. The expansion has disappeared. The Fed's interest rates are going to go up. So the cost of borrowing, whether it's on your credit card or your house or whatever, is going to go up. You know, we didn't have time to talk about another Michelle Singletary column talking about depression. Debt collectors are now allowed to go after you on social media.
That's right.
You'll
open your Twitter page and say, hi, Citizens One here.
Exactly. Hi, here's your go directly to jail card, debtor's prison.
I remember when I was a kid, there was a friend of mine, actually, whose father's name was the exact same name as my father, and she was a good friend of mine in high school, and they used to be calling our house all the time looking for her dad.
It's horrible.
It was really threatening and really nasty. But in one of these pieces that we had in preparation for Michelle, it talked about everything that's expired, Payback Protection Program. ended in March. Unemployment benefits ended in September. Federal eviction moratorium expired last summer. And the last round of stimulus payments arrived in America's bank account last spring. So we are in the midst of this Omicron thing. At least people aren't getting too sick, or most people aren't getting too sick if you've been vaccinated. And the help is basically dried up.
And by the way, there's a fix for almost every single one of the things we talk about in this Build Back Better bill, which as of the moment appears to be going absolutely nowhere.
Right.
Congress
Manchin,
can help.
I love him. I love
Who?
Joe Manchin.
Joe Manchin. He's a good guy.
He's a good guy. Bob from Amherst. Thank you for calling. Oh, Amherst, New Hampshire. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Bob. What's up?
Well, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
My wife and I are senior citizens, and I'm 77. She's 75. We received a notice from Medicare that our premiums are going to go from $300 a month to $340 a month, primarily because of a new drug for Alzheimer's that hasn't been approved by the FDA. But I just think of Bernie Sanders and talking about pre-Medicare for all, and senior citizens have been impacted by this new rate hike because we're both on fixed income Social Security, it just is, it's a burden that I hope that the government can look at and help out senior citizens.
Well, you know, Bob, Bernie Sanders, who I think has been a hero in all this, thought it might be humane for people on Medicare to have their vision, their hearing, and their dental needs taken care of by the federal government. I'm with him on that. And as you probably know, even if this Build Back Better thing does become law, my understanding is while he's still fighting, hearing assistance and, or is it hearing that's included, vision assistance and dental
assistance
is on the cutting room
Let's
floor.
Face it, Jim, having your teeth, it's overrated.
Right? Bob, good luck. I hope they address it, too.
God, that's awful. What are you supposed to do?
What did you say was the highlight? You said the bright spot in this is that overdraft fees at one bank
overdraft
are being
fees.
Eliminated.
That's right. Well,
it's
I
a
do
pretty
think
thin
that
read, my
it's
friend.
It's a thin read. It's true. But I do think that, you know, they can run ad campaigns. And wouldn't you switch your bank if you were, you know, struggling with overdraft fees?
You know, can I tell you something, though?
What?
Michelle Singletary is a far nicer person than either of us.
When
Michelle Singletary, when I was saying, I hate to be cynical, but there's got to be an ulterior motive. Do you believe Capital One is doing this because they want banking and humanity to be more in line in this country? I have to say, I have at least some skepticism
about
the humanity commitment.
About the motive, but maybe the motive is just that they'll get a lot of bank accounts for people that, are at other banks at the moment. Mm-hmm. Don't you think?
Well, I don't know. I guess maybe that's the bright side. That's the hope, is that people who are over...
I'm looking
by the way, when you were a kid
here,
making no money, weren't you having overdraft fees all the time?
Well, yes.
That was a yes or no question.
That was a time when you could like write checks and you would figure out how many days it would take before the check got to the bank.
Right.
So you'd write the checks.
That's illegal,
and,
by the way.
Yeah, but you would... Well, I'm sorry. I did that thinking,
yeah,
you know, I'm not going to get caught. And occasionally the checks seemed to get there really quickly and you bounced... The check, that's what you called it in the olden days. Maggie from the North Shore. Hi, Maggie.
Hey, Maggie.
Yeah, on the SNAP card. Are you familiar with that?
Sure.
Yes.
Supplemental nutrition. Well, you can't buy hot chicken because it's cooked, and you can't buy diapers.
Mm-hmm.
You can't buy soap. You can't buy toothpaste. But you can buy, I'm sure, candy and Coca-Cola.
Yeah,
I don't know about that. Are some insane restrictions, like prepared food, as you described
a
minute ago.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
You're right. Hot at the point of sale.
Yeah. Diapers, that's kind of surprising that you can't buy diapers. That's a necessity, I would
just
say.
Just keep your hand down there, I guess, is the notion. Maggie, thanks for contributing to this topic that we never should have done and never should have talked. I mean, really? 877-301-8900.
Jim, I'm trying to lighten the mood here, and you're not helping. You're just
you know,
lighting.
Also, we didn't get that. Michelle Singletary listed the top five in a column that thankfully we didn't get to, a top five, personal finance New Year's resolutions that people make. Is there one of those that anybody can afford to do right now? Pay off your debt at a higher rate, prepare a budget. Have you ever had a budget in your whole life, by the way, even when you had no money?
I'm not very good at that kind of thing.
But
you know, it's very
important.
It's very important. Everybody that's Michelle Singletary and everybody else who gets financial advice said you need to have a budget. I'm working on it, Jim. That's one of my New Year's resolutions. I'm going to get the budget done this year. Sean from Sharon,
thanks for
calling.
It's on Marjorie's bucket list.
It's on my bucket list. That's right.
Hello, Sean. What's up?
Hi. Yeah, I heard you talking about credit card you know, using the credit card as basically as credit.
Yes.
You know, and when I had the child tax credit, I was using that $500 to pay my child care expenses.
Mm-hmm.
And now that it's gone, basically it's just going on my credit card, and I'm looking at, you know, maybe like 4 more months before I have the ability to pay that anymore.
Well, so you're a perfect person to call, Sean. You should call or write a note to Joe Manchin. He suggests that by getting that extra couple of $100 a month, you were just going to sit home and not work. In fact, you were even more able to work because of the extra money, because it allowed you to deal with your child care expenses. The exact opposite of what his argument is to allow this to disappear. Sean, we wish you luck. You know, that I'm really glad that guy, Sean, just called. That's a wonderful point we should have made to Michelle. Is the whole notion, Manchin's objection, primary objection, is it's a disincentive to work.
Well, it's ridiculous.
One would argue, as Sean just made the point,
you can't afford to work because you can't afford the child care.
Exactly.
These women drop out of the workplace? Don't get me started on this. You know, maybe if you went after more of these deadbeat dads and really made them pay. Everything always falls on mom, doesn't it, when these guys disappear. I mean,
so
I know
what you're good at? You're good at finding a bright note. We're done with this, thank God. So why don't you end this discussion with, like, the positive that came out of this thing. And don't mention Capital One again and getting rid of overdraft fees. Okay, go ahead.
Well, there wasn't all that much positive, except that the interest rates are probably going to go up slowly instead of all at once, so you can have time to prepare for being unable to afford anything, Jim. That's the
other positive note is it's probably going to be months before that first caller, Jasmine, defaults on her Peloton payments.
You know,
so she'll have the machine for at least another couple of months.
You know something? In a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to Juliet Kimer after the news. And here's what we could be grateful for, Jim. We're not in Virginia. We were not stuck on black ice for 24 hours with no gas, freezing cars, the kids in the car. Where did you go to the bathroom? Did you run into the woods and run back to the car? I have no idea. But she's going to tell us how we might have handled this differently. And she's also going to tell us about another, you know, really upbeat topic, the January 6th insurrection. We're almost to the anniversary of that. Our national security expert, Juliet Kimer, is next. You are listening to 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. First, it's Harvard's Juliet Kimer, a day ahead of the one-year anniversary of the January 6th insurrection. Then we'll be joined by Lauren Kennedy. She's co-president of the nonprofit Neighborhood Villages. She'll talk about all things child care and early education and initiatives her group is spearheading to provide greater access to more affordable, quality child care and better wages for those who provide it.
Then our resident medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, is back to explain the latest confusing guidance from CDC on COVID isolation, plus prenatal tests predicting horrible genetic deformities that turn out to make predictions that are mostly wrong. Then GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen on arts and culture around town, all that and more. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Hello again, Jim.
You know, Marjorie, I just had a good idea. I know it's not in our, at least our prepared outline, but just to raise people's spirits like we've been doing the whole show, maybe we can talk about debtor's prison sometime in the next hour. Do you think? I think that would lift. So the House committee investigating the Capitol insurrection is honing in on former President Trump's inner circle and his connection to conservative media. On the eve of the anniversary of the attacks tomorrow, the committee has asked Sean Hannity to appear to answer questions about his knowledge of what the Trump team was planning. Joining us now to discuss this and whether New Hampshire is trying to do its best imitation of Virginia the last couple of days on the highways is national security expert Juliette Kayyem. Juliette is an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Happy New Year, Juliette. It's good to see you.
Good to see you both. Happy New Year.
Well, Juliette, before we get to January 6th, I am dying to know, as a national security person, what you thought of people being stranded 19 hours, 20 hours, 24 hours. The guy that ran for vice president,
Tim Kaine,
stuck 19 hours, I think he said, in a traffic jam because of black ice and accidents. I mean, couldn't somebody have gotten people out of there faster than that?
No, I mean, and this is why I have a lot of questions and no good answers. But of course, the weather predictions seemed pretty accurate. They knew how fast it was going to come and how strong the storm was going to be. As we know up here in New England, you close down the highways because you don't want people stuck, but you also have to clear them for first responders. And what happened was they didn't do that fast enough. And so then you just had layer upon layer of these poor souls stuck. Not their fault. I don't quite understand how people could think that it was their fault. The highway's open, they get on it, and then you can't bring in rescue capacity because it's either too dangerous or it's too slippery. So that explains the delay in getting them out. It does not explain how that happened in the first place. And those are sort of my big questions right now. In any planning for a potential storm like that, like literally in the playbook, number one is close down transportation. You just don't want people out, make it difficult for them to be out. We do that all the time here, even sometimes when it's not necessary, you just do it as a precaution.
You know, by the way, my understanding is I just spoke to a friend in Virginia, and they say that if Governor Northam, who's obviously the outgoing governor, hadn't been busy preparing to go out in blackface, he actually could have dealt with this this problem. Do you believe he survived that? By the way, we don't talk about that anymore.
I know.
It's really
incredible.
Extraordinary, though, when you think about it, that there weren't people who ran out of gas and therefore were beginning to freeze in their cars, or people that had medical conditions. I mean, this was... Go ahead.
Right. No, I mean, as you know, as I've said before here, that, you know, people, when bad blizzards happen and you hear, you know, a dozen people died, or even a couple decades ago when nearly 100 people died in the major blizzard in the 70s, a very small proportion of those are deaths related to snow, and they are almost all carbon monoxide related. Yeah. And that seems to me pretty remarkable that did not happen. Now, of course, there was help on foot, so I think people managed to get certain things, but they were going to the bathroom on the sides, they were raiding whatever food they had. I can't imagine if you had a kid in the car, that would just be a nightmare. But I would, if I were Virginia DOT, Department of Transportation, I would start figuring out how you explain this one.
You know, before you leave it, you touched on the topic that was nearest and dearest to my heart, is having to pee 400 times during the 24 hours. Didn't Larry David do something on Curb Your Enthusiasm where he invented this thing where a man, I'm sorry to leave women out of this for the moment, a man could pee in place or whatever it was?
Yes, that's right.
It was in football stadiums. That's
the
place where you're supposed to be.
You don't have this bottle with you.
I mean,
exactly.
Wow. Didn't want to miss third down and 10,
all of the important needs. No, it is. It's you don't want to know what people did to survive. Like, the less we know, the better off. But it is a remarkable.
So, Juliette, obviously, everybody knows tomorrow is January 6th. Originally, until yesterday, we thought there was going to be a great juxtaposition of Congress having some sort of prayer event while Donald Trump was doing a doubling down on the big lie thing at Mar-a-Lago. He canceled it for whatever reason, blaming the select committee. You know, I'm curious to know what you think a year out, what the threat level is, because I think you have a different position. We had A.C. Thompson on yesterday, who is from ProPublica, who's been studying extremism in America for 4 years. He just did, it played on PBS last night, American Insurrection. And his film ends with him or somebody, I can't remember, saying Charlottesville, essentially where it started or ginned up. Charlottesville and January 6th were not bookends, meaning it didn't end on January 6th. Where are we a year out, would you
say? I'm the same way. You know, we're still in this insurrection. So, you know, given my work, you know, in terms of just what the threat environment is, there are sort of three takeaways a year later, and then we can get to the politics of it. But I'm just talking about the radicalization.
Sure.
The first is that it's very localized. So we know that now. So we're going to have tremendous focus on the Capitol. But what happened was that centralization that you saw where Donald Trump picks a place and a time really was an aberration, that what we're seeing is that radicalization. And when I say radicalization, what I mean by that is the violence or the threat of violence as a political motivation, right? So that is what's happening. So it's very localized at the school district level, at the local level. You see it on attacks on secretaries of state and others. The second is a unique aspect of what's happening in the radicalization world is these people are meeting online, so very ISIS-like in terms of radicalization, but then they are meeting physically. So that is sort of a new trend that we're seeing, that they sort of find each other online and then actually take that step. So when you mm-hmm. think about coordination and conspiracy, those are the things that one looks at. The third is, of course, the merging of a political philosophy, if you can even call it that anymore, with all other conspiracies, from the anti-vaxxers to the child pornography and whatever. So you get this hate stew, but its unifying theme is still an animation, still the sort of the right wing extremism that animated January 6th last year. So those are sort of on the threat of extremism front. There's other extremism. I'm well aware of that. It does not match what we're seeing on the right wing front. That's what we're seeing. And then you're seeing sort of the counter to that through the committee, through the January 6th committee, through the prosecutions and other things. I do want to note, though, on Trump's decision not to speak tomorrow, what there are different theories of it, but one is certainly that the GOP did not want him to get a lot of attention tomorrow. They're trying to cowardly crawl their way through tomorrow. But none of it has to do with that he's wrong. I mean, this is the amazing thing. All the stories I'm reading are he wasn't going to get enough press. They didn't want him to do it. None of it is he's crazy. The former president is crazy and is animating a lie that is believed by a huge proportion of his party. I will say finally, because I do like to end with some good news. The polling is all over the place about January 6th and the committee. But the consistent polling shows, don't just look at Republicans, because I would give up on them at this stage, that about 74% of Americans do believe that January 6th was an attack on democracy and support the work of the January 6th committee. That may be why you're hearing McConnell and other GOP senators begin to not condemn it in the way they had before.
By the way, we have a little sentence or two from McConnell in December, which really surprised me.
Yes.
Obviously the most powerful Republican in Congress. Here's Mitch McConnell.
I do think we're all watching, as you are, what is unfolding on the House side. And it will be interesting to reveal all the participants who were involved.
What's the message there, do you think, Julia?
I think it is. I think it's a message to his people that the strategy cannot be to attack the committee. And secondly, that continuing to isolate Trump as outside the mainstream of the GOP, even though he clearly is the GOP, McConnell views as politically beneficial because he's looking at a Senate races of swing states. And he's worried the polling, whatever you see online, the polling is consistently that the majority of Americans, in particular majority of independents, just view January 6th as a real, real threat to our democracy. So I take comfort in those numbers. Now he may come out on January 7th swinging against the committee, but I don't think so. And I know there's a lot of concern about pacing, in particular with Merrick Garland and the committee and how long it's taking. I think a different way to look at it, and this is me with my political hat on, is the closer you get these bombshells to the midterms, the Democrats clearly view that as a strategy. And so what you're seeing is this drip, drip, drip out of the committee. You know, they're talking about open primetime hearings into March and April. We know people in Trump's inner circle are speaking because they're starting to report that they have firsthand knowledge of where he was and what he was saying. And this narrative that Representative Cheney, who has emerged, you know, really impressive and calm and you know, with strong moral sentiment, you know, this idea that it's the acts of commission as well as the acts of omission, what he didn't do in that 90-minute period, that really are the focus of the committee.
Well, you know, before we leave this, I wasn't going to ask that, but one of the big debates that's going on is, you know, Liz Cheney is the one who broke the news the other day that we have firsthand knowledge that for 187 minutes, Donald Trump was sitting in the dining room off the Oval Office just watching television and doing nothing. And a big debate in the legal community, and you're a pretty good lawyer, is can inaction in a circumstance like that be a crime? Can it be?
I don't think so. I think you would need something more. So this is such a good question, because I do think we need to look at the response to January 6th and the protection of our democracy on several fronts. So a lot of people focus on the criminal liability of Trump. I tend not to focus on that. For a variety of reasons, I think it would be hard. I'm not sure, you know, what a case like that would look like. Criminal liability having to do with January 6th, he may have criminal liability for the financing stuff, which is what the AG in New York is looking at, or Georgia. Right, or Georgia. Exactly. But I do think that the if you look at it in terms of what we call in counterterrorism circles, sort of, you know, isolating the leader, or we call it decapitating the leader, but that's only figurative, is that in terms of radicalization, the more that you can isolate Trump, so the cancellation of his speech, for example, the still being off of Twitter, the lawsuits against him, all of that. And let's just remember, he cannot fill a room. He's doing these big events, selling tickets with Bill O'Reilly. They're about a quarter filled right now. So all of that from a radicalization perspective is the lens I look at it through. I know lawyers look at through the criminal liability lens, and I don't know how strong of a case that would be, but I know from the political and ideological side, omission is something that I think the American public can get. A crime of omission, whether it is in fact a crime, is a narrative that the American public can get. He sat there, and what was he doing? And remember, I just remind people, right before Christmas, we learned that a number of people were trying to reach Trump through the chief of staff, including Ivanka, my understanding is his daughter.
She apparently walked into that dining room twice and asked him to stop.
Yeah, yeah. Are there draft recordings of his videos? Remember, he finally came out with a video, but apparently it was the first or second, it was the second or third version. So all that stuff goes, you know, may not, you know, the courtroom is only one forum for our democracy, and I, you know, fight on every front, of course, but some of the fronts are less obvious, but I still think pretty effective.
Well, you know, speaking of courts and criminal charges or no criminal charges, Merrick Garland is finally going to say something today, and there are a lot of people unhappy with him, particularly in the Democratic Party. Yeah. He's speaking at 2:30. I'm assuming if people feel frustrated with his inaction on some fronts, I mean, there are 700 people who've been charged, obviously, out of the insurrection. But if people are still unhappy about him not going after the higher-ups, I assume they're not going to feel any better when he's done his speech. He's not going to say anything other than rhetoric about democracy, is he? Or is
right, because there's no cases. I mean, well, let's put it, he will talk about the 600-plus cases that are going on. And since we've last been on, I mean, some of these violent trespassers, because there was the nonviolent trespassers and the violent trespassers, you know, they're getting 4 and 5 years now. This is not insignificant time at this stage. Like, this is, so those are cases that he'll mention probably in, you know, by bulk number, how many are going on, but he cannot mention any grand jury or anything. It's going to, for the people who want him to say Trump is in the bullseye for me, I mean, they're going to be disappointed. And I think I get a little bit frustrated by the clamoring, because first of all, I think we don't know what's going on. So I, you know, and his duty is to protect a case. His duty isn't to make Twitter happy and progressives happy. And number two is, if nothing is going on, it's sort of ironic that people who spent 4 years saying we should not politicize the Department of Justice are essentially asking Merrick Garland to do what they want the politics to do. And I feel very uncomfortable with that. I just,
you accept it, Juliet, in all fairness, though, there are a lot of really smart lawyers.
Oh, I know.
Who
I
believe
know.
That Donald Trump and his allies at the top have committed crimes. And I would argue that while most people who I respect, regardless of their politics, mm-hmm. by the way, think that James Comey exceeded crossed the lines of responsibility prior to the election vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton, James Comey decided it was in the interests of America and was important enough for the American people to know what was being investigated and what wasn't. Why can't Merrick Garland decide that with an election coming up later this year, what's going on or not going on with the former president of the United States is important enough? Can he at least tell us if there's an investigation, a grand jury convened, anything?
No, you've just ruined the grand jury. I mean, this is what I don't understand. If a grand jury is convened right now, let's just think of a scenario, right?
And we don't know.
A grand jury is, and we don't know. And that's the other problem is we don't know, right?
Of course.
So if a grand jury is convened, he acknowledges that grand jury, right? That one, it exposes the grand jury to all sorts of shenanigans that you don't want to expose them to. But all of a sudden, as a defense attorney, you now can claim that this was a political witch hunt of which he announced before the grand jury had even decided. Right. So I, as I said, if we can look at this on multiple fronts, and I'm not saying give the benefit of the doubt to Merrick Garland, I don't know what's going on. But I also don't know what's not going on in the sense I've read.
You're right.
So, just can't even imagine what those words would be from him, because he announces that a grand jury is meeting to for a criminal investigation against the former president of the United States, who is not a candidate. So it might be different if he were a candidate who is not a candidate. Mm-hmm. Before they've made a decision. You know, I mean, I'm not a defense attorney, but I can imagine that would strike
that he was prejudicing the prosecution.
Yeah. So that's my take. I appreciate every forum to protect our democracy. Trust me, I do.
Well, keep your political hat on for one more question for me on this.
Yeah.
What I despair over is that while the January 6th committee has uncovered a lot of news. They've talked about now, I guess they want to get Sean Hannity to voluntarily come in and talk about his concerns about prior to the insurrection, even though he claimed after the insurrection that it was Antifa and stuff like that.
Right.
If any of this really matters in terms of the mess we're in, because you see more and more people, we're going to talk to a psychologist tomorrow who's dealt with getting people out of cults and getting them back to reality.
Yeah.
But it seems as though we have millions of Americans, many millions of Americans who are kind of in an alternative universe, and that the January 6th committee could find is we like the joke about, you know, Donald Trump shooting somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't matter.
I think that might be true. And I've definitely sort of worry less about that group. I mean, I believe.
Why we worry less. I want to worry less, too. Why are you worrying less?
Because because the majority of America, that's not the majority. In other words, what I want to do, where I would expend my energy, I feel the same way about the unvaccinated, is not why are they still unvaccinated? And I'm different than a lot of people. I know that I'm a little bit harsher about the unvaccinated than you would probably want your doctor to be, but a little bit like the majority is protecting itself. It believes in a common good. It believes in, you know, in some notion of our responsibility as citizens of the United States. That's the vast majority of Americans. Buttress them, and the rest will either follow, or they will be disgruntled for the rest of their lives. And there's going to be a percentage of the American public that's always been that way, but that will be that way and identify with Trump. But you know, that to me is of I worry about radicalization of that group, but most of that group is not radicalized. We have to understand that most of that group is not willing to take up arms and stuff. The radicalization is of a much more discreet and scary group. But the Sean Hannity, I think, is relevant because it shows an understanding of violence as the result of what was likely to come on January 6th. That knowledge factor will go into whatever if Garland is doing anything, but certainly the January 6th committee they all knew on January 5th what was going to happen. And so did Trump. I mean, come on, he used the word fight, what, like 2 dozen times that morning?
Even if it is not a majority, you have a problem, I think, with the way the system is, in fact, going to be rigged for 2022, and with people, partisans, overseeing elections and making it more difficult to vote. So it doesn't have
unless
to be.
Unless Congress passes the two voting
reforms. Right, unless, well, exactly. Yeah. And,
but I guess and, that's the thing. That's it doesn't where, have to be a majority, where, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that is, that's, there's no question about that, but in terms of, I'm just thinking of strategy. So in terms of strategy, is the expenditure of my time worried about people that are going to believe whatever they want to believe because they believe in him? Or is it going to be figure out ways in which the majority, the vast majority, including, as we know, independents, and not an unsizable part of the Republican Party, believes that this is nonsense. So it's not all of them, but look, the success is in how few people each day consider themselves Republicans. It is a party that will be identified with radicalization and anti-democracy. And so the only solution for that party now is a new party. I don't think.
Well, the
I don't
good
think
news
the GOP
is let me
is redeemable.
End on the good news. The good news is a growing entity of the independents, and only 40% of independents think we should use violence against our government. So that's really an upbeat way.
I think that polling is really weird because it is capturing the left as well. Like, I think that the polling on how many people would use violence, it's clearly capturing the right to a much greater extent, but it is capturing, if someone killed Biden and sat in the Oval Office, would you consider violence? Well, the understanding of what January 6th was and the support for the committee is sort of where that majority comes from. I mean, and given the limited time and resources we have, I feel this way as you know, because I've been saying it now for 8 months. Like, I feel this way about the unvaccinated. Like, enough with their feelings. I'm done with their feelings. It is time the majority just use the tools available to the majority to assert its winning. And righteous, no question about it.
Well, Marjorie and I are living that. We're broadcasting from our homes in locked rooms today. So it's gone really well. Juliet, it's great to see you as always. Happy
Bye,
New Year.
You guys.
Thanks,
Bye.
Juliet.
See you soon. Bye.
Juliet is an analyst for CNN. She's former assistant secretary of the Department of Homeland Security and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Coming up, our child care system is pretty much broken, lots of us would say, and child care and early education workers risk becoming crushed now under the weight of the latest COVID surge, which has ripple effects, of course, in the economy. We're going to talk to Lauren Kennedy of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit working to increase access to child care. Excuse me. She joins us up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Back to Boston Public Radio. She's Marjorie. I'm Jim Browdy. As the latest COVID surge rips through society, child care and early education providers are sounding an alarm. If we shut down, so might the economy. Joining us now to discuss the challenges local organizations are facing is Lauren Birchfield Kennedy. She's co-founder of Neighborhood Villages. It's a nonprofit that works to improve access to affordable child care and early education and to raise the wages of those who provide it. Lauren, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining, because I'm so worked up about this, I can hardly stand it. So let's start with how big a mess is the child care situation in right now?
Well, I will say this. We have our incredible, incredible early education and care providers and educators to thank for their commitment to showing up day in and day out for the Commonwealth children, for our families. You know, as you mentioned, we need childcare to stay open if we want our families to be able to go to work and keep our economy going. So I'll start there and then sort of say, yeah, it's tough out there right now. With Omicron, you know, having its impact on the education system, on so many other industries, childcare is in no different position. Staff members becoming exposed, becoming ill, makes it more difficult to keep classrooms open. But that being said, we are so proud of what our providers are doing to keep teachers healthy and to keep classrooms open for children.
You know, until I read the Globe story that you're quoted in yesterday about the mess, which so many childcare places, despite their wonderful work, are facing, I haven't thought about all the comparative disadvantages that such places face as compared to schools. A ton of the kids are below the age at which they can be vaccinated. You can't expect a kid of that age to be able to keep a mask on. There's smaller settings, all those kinds of things. So I know that one of the things you've been trying to do through your organization is make test availability, which is almost an oxymoron in this society right now, test availability greater for some of these settings. What's the state of affairs? Who's chipping in? What's the state of things? And give us an update.
So the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has actually been leading the nation in setting up a comprehensive testing program for the early education and care sector. To the best of our knowledge, we are the only state that has built true architecture and infrastructure around how we both implement surveillance pooled testing for early education and care providers who wish to participate, and now moving into a all hands on deck distribution of rapid tests into the field as well, in recognition that we need to be consistently testing our teachers as well as young children, because as you mentioned, many of the children in these programs are not yet eligible for vaccine.
Do you have the, I mean, I know you delivered tens of thousands of rapid tests. I think it was 40 grand or 40,000 or something. I know people are so sick of me saying every day how appalling it is that we're holding our breath waiting for 500 million tests from the rapid tests from the federal government, which I don't even know if the contract's been signed, and they're all going to be gone in a day. Are there enough rapid tests, even if we are leading the nation, to fill the needs of the providers and kids in these classes and these settings?
In this moment, we are grateful to the Department of Early Education and Care for what it has done to get its hands on a supply of rapid tests. And they are working, and Neighborhood Villages is working day in and out to be able to get as many tests into the field as is possible. So that's both a supply chain challenge to get these tests. And then we appreciate the patience of programs waiting in line to receive them. We have more than 2,100 programs who have signed up within really the last 24 hours, raising their hands and saying we need these tests as fast as possible. So we thank them for their patience as we work as fast and as quickly as we can to get those out into the field. But what I'll reiterate again is we are able to do that because the state, since June of 2021, has really invested in building an infrastructure, an architecture, and a plan to be able to meet moments like this.
We're talking with Lauren Kennedy, co-founder of Neighborhood Villages. This is a nonprofit that helps provide access to affordable child care and early education. You know, I should know this, but I don't. Do child care workers have to be vaccinated?
My understanding is that they are following the same, you know, rules, regulations, guidance that any of us are. And because these are independent business proprietors, the different early education and care programs may be making their own personal decisions about what the requirements of staff
okay.
are.
Speaking of staff, I miss, you know, when I see the wages of, I know this is nothing new to you or to anybody listening. This is like you can make more as a barista at Starbucks in many cases.
You can make more nearly anywhere.
So are people, is there, I assume, even if it were not Omicron, there's got to be a staffing shortage crisis on steroids, no?
There's a crisis layered upon a crisis. This field has chronically faced workforce shortage issues because, as you say, the wages are so low for a job that is incredibly demanding. And so we've always had a very difficult time recruiting and retaining our talent, particularly when we see our teachers need to go out and, you know, sort of begin families of their own and find themselves mm-hmm. in a position where yeah. they can't afford the same care they're providing to other families. Now, in this moment, as you mentioned, it's not just programs competing with each other for teachers. They're competing against McDonald's. They're competing against Amazon, and we can't. There is no room in this field to raise wages to be at a competitive level because, like any industry, that would mean passing the cost off onto parents, and parents can't pay it. So we are seeing a huge, again, so as you say, crisis on steroids, and really the cry, the demand from the field to our governor, to our administration, and to our legislature is please continue the investment of public funds, of ARPA funds into the field, straight into the hands of providers so that they can make investments in raising salaries and retaining our teachers, particularly in this moment.
Well, I want to find out what your support of the Common Start legislation that you're advocating at Neighborhood Villages Action Fund. But first, who knows what's going to happen to this Build Back Better bill and whether any of it is going to get anywhere. But if it were, what would the fact that you would only have to pay 7% of your income to childcare and also the wage part, how could that have changed the childcare situation, even if it's not going to happen?
Well, right. So the good news here for us here in Massachusetts is that we have an independent bill. So there's Build Back Better at the federal level. If that bill passes, we like keep fingers crossed when that bill passes, that will provide an influx of federal dollars into a state so that they can then go and implement, you know, their own approach to a more well-funded and healthier early education and care system, abiding by, you know, the laws and requirements and Build Back Better. That being said, Massachusetts does not have to wait for Build Back Better. We, the Common Start Coalition, of which Neighborhood Villages Action Fund is a member, filed a bill in February of 2021. It has a very long name that I do not actually recall because we all just refer to it as the Common Start legislation. And what this bill would do is refinance our early education and care system. It would make it more affordable for families by raising income eligibility for financial assistance, raising the amount of financial assistance for which a family is eligible, and providing funding directly to programs. And that last piece is very, very important because what it then does is support capacity. It recognizes that we need our early education and care providers in business with their doors open. The reason it all fell apart so quickly in March of 2020 and why we're looking at sort of similar vulnerability in this moment is because our childcare system is entirely reliant on enrollment and tuition. We need to shift into a mentality closer to K-12 or even closer to a fire station that we need them open, even if there's fluctuation in use and enrollment. And so those two pieces of Common Start are really critical. And the bill would also require an investment in early education, workforce and educators to bring up their salaries to be more akin to what one might make as a preschool or pre-K teacher in the public schools.
I can't believe, Lauren, that you're who you are and you don't know this is called an act providing affordable and accessible high-quality early education.
You'll forgive me. You'll forgive me.
Child development and well-being and support the economy in the Commonwealth. That is its name. I just looked it up. Can I understand something that Elizabeth Warren herself explained to us on the air months ago, the 7% cap thing that she is mm-hmm. sort of the parent of that is in the Build Back Better deal, is a comparable provision in the state legislation that's pending that would not only cap at 7% of your income how much you spend on childcare, but also make it free for people at the lowest end of the spectrum financially?
Yeah, and we would argue that our bill, in fact, may be even more generous and more robust than Build Back Better. So under the Common Start legislation, if you are below 50% of state median income, it would be free to you as a family. Hmm. And then applying a progressive sliding scale of no more than 7% once you right sort of get up to a higher level of income. But there's no income cap. In the Common Start legislation, it's not means tested. In Build Back Better, you are no longer eligible for a subsidy once you hit 250% of state median income. And in Massachusetts, our commitment is that this is a public good And like K-12, we are going to treat it that way and understand that families will make a fair contribution, but that we will not be means testing the program as a whole, at least not in this moment.
Lauren Kennedy, you hear all these whopping figures that daycare can cost somebody $35,000 a year, you know, these astronomical amounts of money, at the same time that the wages they're paying to daycare workers are so low. So explain to people why that is. The wages are so low, yet the costs are so high.
Because provision of high quality childcare is expensive, and it should be. It is an education that we provide to children that requires adults to be in the classroom. And when you look at K-12, childcare is very, very different. You need a lot of adults in a given classroom, particularly in an infant classroom, particularly in a toddler classroom. We don't want one adult for 20 infants. Not only is that not safe, it is also not providing the high quality educational experience that each one of these children deserve. So when you look at a classroom in which you may have multiple adults, that is why it is so expensive. So, you know, when we actually, Neighborhood Villages partnered with a podcast producer called Lemonada Media and broke this down. How is it that nobody is saving any money? Nobody is making any money. And the answer is because it's a fundamentally broken market, where the cost of providing the service is more than a family can afford. It's also more expensive than a childcare provider can afford. And in order to make it work, you have to suppress the wages of the educator. And we need to stand up and say, this is not right. It is unjust. This is a workforce of predominantly women of color. And so if we are ready to make, and we must be ready to make, a statement that this is a public good for children, and it needs to be an equitable system, that means raising the wages of educators while making it more affordable. And the only way you bridge that gap is through investment of public funds, which is what the Common Start legislation calls for.
You know, I don't know if this will be totally useful, Lauren Kennedy, but let's do it anyway. You touched on sort of the philosophical underpinning, at least to me, and I'm guessing to Marjorie, of why this all makes sense. It's sort of, to me, the analogy that to why at least some portion of higher education should be free. You know, 100 years ago, whenever the hell it was that we started saying free K through 12, the notion was that's what somebody needed to succeed in this society, to have a internal level playing field. Well, that was decades, if not a century ago. Now you need a higher education and you need an early education. If you confront or if you meet with a legislator who is reluctant to buy in on something like this, and you say to him or her, make that argument that if you believe the K through 12 should be free, because if it was on the same model as early education, it'd be just as unaffordable an answer to Marjorie's question as early education is. What is the response to that in light of all the data about how important, how critical this is to the development of a kid? What do they say to you?
I think what is encouraging is that it seems to be understood very much so in a way that perhaps it was ignored before, that this is the best investment that we can make in a child. This is where they learn their social emotional skills, which we all need as we move through life. This is where they begin early literacy. This is how they start kindergarten on an equal footing with other kids who were able to participate in early learning. So if you care about equity in K-12 and educational attainment, it starts at birth. We also cannot afford not to make this investment, not only because we're tying our children's hands behind their back before they get started, but also because of what we know about its impact on the workforce, on families' ability to maintain their financial security, to pursue employment opportunities. We still have more than 1 million women sitting on the sidelines after the pandemic because mothers have not been able to make their way back into the workforce. We're leaving a ton of revenue on the table by not providing parents with the support that they need to go to work and to maximize their earning potential. So when you sit in front of a legislator, I think honestly, the greatest arguments we have to make is why is it worth the public investment, unfortunately? And it's dollars and cents, but what COVID sort of tore the veil off of is the amount that we lose by ignoring the root of the problem.
So you know, pretty kind to people. Just one second on Beacon Hill. And my experience is that the Beacon Hill is where most good ideas go to die. I read that it's a testimony. There was, of course, nobody testifying against this, which also probably guarantees its demise. What are the honest, raise your right hand, what are the honest prospects for this common sense, absolutely necessary thing to happen? I assume if I'm a person on Beacon Hill, you may not like this. They're probably saying to themselves, let's see if the feds do the right thing, if they do build back better. If they do build back better, even if Commons starts a little bit better, as you described before, that will fill most of the need. Well, let's assume that Manchin never comes around, Sinema never comes around, and there's no build back better. What are the prospects for this Commons start agenda, would you say?
I would say I think that depends on us. So I often, you know, listen to your show driving to pick up one of my children from school. And so for any, you know, family, anybody who cares about a kid, anybody who was a kid who's listening to this right now, please go to the Common Start Coalition's website. Please go to the Neighborhood Villages Action Fund website, because there you will find opportunities to connect to the coalition, to get involved, to contact your legislator. We will help you with a script. We will help you with what to say, because I do think that this is going to require people to mobilize, mm-hmm. get out into the virtual streets and tell your legislator, not only is this what I want, but when I go to the polls, just like other issues that are top of mind for families, this is going to be one mm-hmm. of them. And I think that that piece is really, really important, because as I mentioned before, this is an expensive investment. And right. all of us are hoping that the federal government will be able to offset. I mean, in Build Back Better, it would cover 90% of the cost of the new early education and care program contemplated under the federal legislation. But if it stalls, we have a moral responsibility here in Massachusetts to do the right thing anyway. And if our legislators have trouble hearing that, then it's important that we as families, we as educators, we as providers, do the work ourselves to make sure that it doesn't die.
Lauren Kennedy, we're running out of time here, but I did want to ask you, historically, there's been a lot of hostility, even though most people have kids and most people do need childcare, to daycare. You know, there's been a certain hostility toward it. Of course, I think that's because it's women that want the daycare and women's are doing the work most of the time. It's a certain anti-woman thing going on there. But do you think that that's going away, or do you still hear that sort of, you know, you don't, can't afford a kid, don't have a kid mentality, which really sends me into, you know, the stratosphere?
You know, I think we're fortunately in a different place than we were in, you know, 1971, 50 years ago, when Nixon vetoed our last great shot at having universal affordable early education and care. And then I think, you know, you fast forward 50 years, it shouldn't have taken this long, it shouldn't have taken a pandemic. But the pandemic changed everything. We realize now this is not a question of if you have a kid, you should figure out how to raise your kid. This is a question of a basic social investment in a child and a basic social investment in supporting our families and their ability to contribute to the economy, contribute to society. Like, stop it. Let's forget this idea that a family should have no support until their child is five. It was always arbitrary. It's sexist. It's racist. Let's have an honest dialogue and move forward.
Now, by the way, the only reason I laugh is not what you're saying. One of my favorite expressions is stop it. That is exactly how I feel about 95% of what's going on. Lauren, thanks so much for your time and your work. We really appreciate it.
And good luck with this effort, because it is a desperate situation and people do so need it. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I want to say one thing and then I will go, is that if you are an early education and care provider, maearlyedtesting.com is where you can get your free rapid test.
Say that again,
please. Say that again, yeah.
What's the site?
maearlyedtesting.com.
Great. Thanks for doing
that. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate us. Lauren Kennedy is co-founder of Neighborhood Villages, a nonprofit that works to improve access to affordable child care. They're trying to get some legislation passed on Beacon Hill, and she told you how you can help. Coming up, our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, on the CDC's confusing rollout of guidance on COVID. That's next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As many of us return to society after the holidays, we've been met with excruciatingly long lines at COVID testing facilities, empty shelves at the CVS, and confusion about CDC's updated guidance, such as it is, on isolation times. Joining us to talk through all of this is the very tired Art Kaplan. He was on CNN at 6 o'clock this morning. He is the doctor's William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair at NYU School of Medicine, where he also directs the Division of Medical Ethics. Well, we hope you look relatively wide awake. Happy New Year, Art Kaplan.
Hey.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, this should be good.
Yes, I am here.
Good.
So,
present. Present.
You're present. Okay. Well, I'm sure you'll rise to the occasion, Art, because you always do. So let's start with confusion about the CDC's updated guidelines that Jim just mentioned. I mean, isolate 5 days, isolate 10 days, back to 5 days, get a negative test. I'm confused. I'm sure everybody's confused. Are they confusing us? And what should we be doing?
They are crystal clear. If you are home and you spin three times around and you don't seem to fall over from being dizzy, then you may take a test. But if it's negative, you should go to your CVS and wait in line for another test for a few days. By the way, one of the things I love about lines for testing is you're in line with all the symptomatic people at maximum infectiousness. I mean, could this be dumber? Yes, they have confused us, to answer your question. The advice has been inconsistent and shifting, and it isn't because of changes in the science. Sometimes that happens. You get new facts, you change the policy. Here it was 10 days. They realized that was going to have too big an economic impact on people getting to work, especially in crucial industries, so they shifted to 5. It was a decision about stay home, driven by economics, and they never explained it. They didn't say what they were doing.
You know, we've been talking about this with you for 2 years. It seems to me, as a non-expert in the field, there's almost nothing as important as consistent messaging. I understand science changes, but as you said, it didn't change here. And, you know, forget the people who are the crazies in this. I'm talking about people who are in the middle or just scared and confused. When you have the CDC drop it from 10 to 5 with no negative test to free you, and then Fauci says, well, maybe there should be a negative test, and the CDC decides yesterday, I believe, no, you don't need a negative test. How is even the most science-honoring kind of person, you know, supposed to live their life unless they're, like, knee-deep in this stuff? It really is troubling. And you add to that the fact that we still don't know, talk about testing, when those 500 million tests, which are going to be gone in about 3 minutes, are going to appear, and what's going to happen after the 500 million tests disappear. It is really
By the way, in my state, just to pile on to that, the governor, whose name is Lamont, promised in Connecticut that he would have 3 million tests, and they're not being delivered, and he can't figure out why. And so not only is the messaging about what to do to protect yourself inconsistent, promising is starting to get fallacious. You know, I'm going to get you 500 million doses. They're supposed to be here. Excuse me, not doses, tests. They're supposed to be here now. They're not here now. And so what I think is we really have a crisis of confidence, and it calls for a reset. I mean, I think we need some of these fireplace chats a little bit more than Joe
That's
coming out
idea.
For 20 seconds and telling us not to panic. I think we should sit down with Fauci, then maybe the CDC lady and Walensky, and just do some 20-30 minute things, take some calls, you know, regain your credibility.
You know, I have a question that I'm confused about. If you do test positive, and half of everybody seems to be testing positive for Omicron these days, and then you go through your 5 days after your test and you're feeling fine, I have read that you can test positive 4 days after you're no longer contagious, and yet we're supposed to take this test on 5 days. So how do you know? I mean, I guess you can go back to masked everywhere you go, but...
Well, they're saying you should stay masked.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think that is sound advice if you've been positive, whether it's 5 up to 10 days out. It is true that some people will respond because the antibodies will linger in their system, so they'll get a positive test result. But we don't really understand Omicron infection, is the honest answer, Marjorie. It's not clear that you can't transmit it 10 days, even without symptoms, even though you feel fine. So the mask policy is probably what they want to stress for people who are positive. I was going to come back and moan about one other aspect here. Losing faith is also fueled by another number. So we've all seen these numbers, 30% infection rate in Boston, 35% infection rate in New York, whatever it is in Alabama or other parts of the country. You know, those are the positive test results of people who got tested at a PCR place that
exactly.
reported to the Department
exactly.
of Health. Those numbers don't mean anything. So yeah. it's at least, here's an Art Kaplan number. We're at least like 50% more infected because people are taking the tests at home and they don't report them to the state of Rhode Island or anybody
right.
else.
Right.
And then there are people who don't test, and there some of them are positive.
Exactly.
So, you know, we're sitting around with these numbers like, oh, yes, well, it's going up and it's to 30%. By the time they say 30, I'm thinking 50. So why aren't they explaining the basic numbers?
You know, can I add one more thing? I want to make a small correction of something you said, Marjorie. You said, you know, after the 5 days, you take the test and you can still be positive a few days. That's one of the things I was talking about. That's one of the disagreements. Fauci intimated
right.
the other day, you will have to take a test after 5 days or should. Yesterday, the CDC resisted that and said, you don't need to take a test to get out of the 5-day isolation. So it's just...
By the way, if we had enough tests, I'll predict with 300% certainty that they would say what Fauci said. You can't
I agree with that.
Without a test. There's just no test. That's why CDC is wiggle-waggling around.
We're talking okay. to Art Kaplan. A little that clarified well, things. Thank you for that.
Let's get off COVID for just a minute. We'll get back. But I wanted to talk about what you can find out from pricks of blood. We just had the guilty verdict in the Theranos verdict. Elizabeth Holmes guilty of 4 out of 11 charges of fraud. Let's talk about what she was telling people she could do, and then let's move on to this prenatal story, which is all related to false claims about what you can find out from a little
yeah.
bit of blood.
So Theranos, the company, was built on the idea that instead of us going in and getting blood withdrawn, and, you know, nobody likes the phlebotomist, the person who takes your blood for testing. They take vials of it, right? They're sitting there and you got to fill up test tubes of blood and then they run tests on. What she promised was a test that could operate on a drop of blood and produce the same results. So that would be great. Pinprick instead of these, you know, going through all this rigmarole. Many people hate it. I don't know anybody who likes it. Most people hate it. And much more costly and have to have a trained person to do it and, you know, would save money not to handle the big samples. It was just, it would be great. Unfortunately, they had no idea how to do that. She lied. I mean, she just lied. She went around to investors and said, you know, I got this analyzer that can use a drop of blood and test everything about your diseases that we get out of vials of blood. She put together a board of people, or board of directors on Theranos, that had no idea what she was talking about and never asked her any questions. I don't know why those guys aren't getting prosecuted too. Well, men and women aren't getting prosecuted too. They went along with these reports. In a sense, they're responsible for the fraud that she perpetrated on investors. And the one thing that really bugs me about this trial, really bugs me, is they didn't convict her. And I didn't listen to the trial, I admit, but they didn't convict her of defrauding patients. And this company was out at Walmart. Right. And had other contracts and people got tested and relied on the results of a basically, you know, a fraudulent ripoff scheme, a kind of Bernie Madoff approach to testing. That's, you know, just commonsensically, that looks like fraud on patients to me. Now she's got tough. She was sentenced harshly. She's going to face some real jail time. So, okay. But it was scandalous. There's another company that's been around, or companies that have been trying to do the same thing with genetic testing on samples of tissues taken from fetuses in utero, trying to figure out what tests might produce information about either embryos or later in the development of the fetus about genetic diseases. There was a very good test for Down syndrome. And listeners will know that's controversial. There are some people who say, you know, Down's kids can do a lot and you shouldn't even be screening for that. It isn't clearly a disease. Other parents say it's a bad condition. There are often kids born who with limited capacity don't want that. Anyway, that drove the market for that kind of testing and has been around for a while. But the companies have been touting, they say things like, and we can test for 1,000 other things. Well, it turns out, number one, the 1,000 other things are rare. I mean, you don't see them. The chance of you having them are like one in a gazillion of these very rare, thankfully, genetic diseases. And then attempts to corroborate the accuracy of the tests have not proven true. So, Marjorie, what we've got is people taking a test and ending a pregnancy based on phony information.
Yes.
You know, you don't have to be a moral genius to know that that's pretty heinous. That's just horrible to do that. We'll see what happens with these companies. And I'm not even getting into the debate about what do you do if you got a positive result and it was true. Just put that aside. They're marketing and selling tests that don't work in this sensitive area. Boy, that's
didn't the story say as much as 90% false positives in some of these cases?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes, again, yeah, sometimes 81%, 84%. Yeah. You know what was, there were two other things that were really upsetting about this story to me, besides the fact that this is the New York Times investigation reported in 2014, 6% of women who got bad results did end up having abortions. Those that didn't, after they got bad results, many of them paid for very expensive follow-up tests that can risk a miscarriage if you're late in a pregnancy, or that can't even be done until you're way into your pregnancy. But the FDA has declined to regulate this market. So you have, and they're calling these tests giving you peace of mind and offering you total confidence and highly accurate and reliable in some of these advertisements. I don't understand what the FDA is doing here.
I don't get it. They should be all over regulating these tests. And I don't know why they're not. I literally have no idea. But I do know this looks like you're deceiving your customers, and it's kind of similar to what we just said Elizabeth Holmes did.
You know, can we get back to the Holmes thing? I'm sorry, Marjorie, go ahead. Can we get back to the Holmes thing for just 1 second here? You don't know this, but this is one of my cause celeb that is going nowhere. This story, for reasons that you and Marjorie just talked about, the Theranos, the Elizabeth Holmes trial, actually had huge tentacles that mattered to real people. You know, this wasn't about hyperbole, it's about lying kind of thing, and it tied beautifully into that prenatal testing thing you two were talking about. The fact that there are not cameras in federal courtrooms meant that on television and radio, particularly on television, there was very little coverage, comparatively speaking, of this. Had there been a camera in the courtroom, we would have been hearing about it as one of the lead stories every night and would have learned something that's really important to the lives of many people in this country. And so, once again, this absurd notion that it's fine to have a camera in every state or city courthouse in America, that hasn't disturbed justice. But in a federal courthouse, for some reason, it's going to cause a disaster, is a throwback to another era.
You're wrong about that, Jim, because there are many illustrators who depend for their careers.
That's a very good
point.
Didn't
we get a lot of sketches coming flying out of there?
Yeah. In any case, my little thing. By the way, one of the great points about this, about investors, forget board members, just as an aside, people don't know, one of the $100 million investors was the DeVos, as in Betsy DeVos Foundation.
No way. Yeah.
And the notion that you'd invest $100 million in a company and not do a thorough investigation as to whether or not the product works.
I guess she lost a little bit, but she got a lot left.
That's why I was saying, when are we going to have a little more corporate board accountability?
I agree with you.
Nobody's going to look at it and say, hey, I don't see any published papers in the literature about this. Nobody's verified this independently. These are all internally made claims. And I know people wanted to believe it. They really did. It was like, this would be so good to have a revolution in blood testing this way, less burden on the patients, cheaper, better. You know, I get the hope. But that doesn't make it true.
What was interesting, too, is not only Betsy DeVos, financial manager, got involved with this and spent all her money, but you had Henry Kissinger. You know, Henry Kissinger mm-hmm. is older now, but he's still a pretty smart guy. Mm-hmm. I've seen him on TV. Jim Mattis, who was in the longtime military man, quit the Trump administration mm-hmm. over his upset over the way President Trump conducted himself. So she managed to get... and people have talked about how charismatic she was, and you know, she's a beautiful woman, tall and blonde, and all that kind of stuff. But it's amazing that she could get people of that kind of caliber.
Laughing because I keep thinking, what the heck kind of caliber is that? What do those people know about blood testing or any kind of biological biotechnology stuff? I mean, I'm General Mathis, great guy. I'm sure he's good at doing wars or whatever he does, but I'm not interested in his view about blood. I'm barely interested in my own view. And I was chair of the Blood Safety and Advisory Committee for the United States for 3 years in my life. So
how much did you lose on Theranos?
We're talking not me. I was dubious to begin with.
Hey, Art, can we return for a minute to COVID before we let you go? Yesterday in Boston, I don't know what the numbers are today. Yesterday there were roughly 1,000 school employees in Boston, 461 teachers or 451, I can't remember, who didn't show up, most of which was around COVID, either positive tests or close contacts and that sort of thing. And Massachusetts has been one of the leaders, assuming that the tests are available, in this test and stay thing. And this is the notion where, if you're in close contact and someone in the classroom tests positive, you don't have to go home and isolate yourself as long as you have a negative test every day. I'm assuming that because I can't imagine anybody against this test and stay thing is in my opinion, a brilliant idea to keep kids in school. And we know the consequence of having a kid not be in school for an extended period of time. But this is also a program that is going to suffer dramatically if we can't produce enough rapid tests to keep up with the number of kids that need to take them with the frequency that they need to take them.
Correct? Short interlude here while I pound my head on the desk.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the answer. If we had the darn tests, we wouldn't even be having these fights. Chicago schools say today they're not going in. Right. New York City mayor says, I got to go in. We can't damage the kids anymore. All of this is by the wayside if you have sufficient testing. And so could we begin to plan now for the next wave of whatever COVID is going to bring us and start to at least manufacture and subsidize tests so that every household in America, everyone, this was something that Biden's press secretary sneered at, has 10 tests available. Don't send your kid to school. Don't go to work. Don't go to a sporting event. I mean, testing is just as crucial as vaccination. You're not going to vaccinate your way out of COVID. You need to have the test to sort of restrict the spread. Testing is sadly there. And by the way, I've got another brilliant ethics answer for the school problem, let's call it. Could we just have a 2-week off period? Let this round of COVID max out. Let the government subsidize, if they have to, a little bit of childcare or a little bit of pay, or let employers say, grace period, nobody's fired, 2 weeks off. We see this thing as peaking, the current COVID wave. We're fighting about sending the kids back to school. Wait 2 or 3 weeks, make them all extend to the summer. Sorry, kids. And then, it'll be safer overall. Why are we trying to steer this boat into the COVID storm when if we just waited a bit, I think it'll start to calm down?
Well, even if that's a great idea in the abstract, it is. The government, if they decided to do that, would have to pay for childcare so that people weren't out of work for an additional 2 weeks in some cases.
They couldn't run the child care because.
And I just called Joe Manchin, and Joe Manchin said he doesn't buy your idea, so that's the end of that, Art.
But
sorry.
The child care is in crisis because those kids can't even get
isolate
vaccinated.
On his yacht. I'm sure it could hold thousands. I've seen a picture of that thing, and it looks quite glamorous. I get it. I know it's a burden. Maybe the feds wouldn't do it, maybe counties could do it. But I think you'd wind up saving money if you just held off instead of trying to bounce kids back and forth. You're still going to have problems, teachers out. A lot of the schools are going to be closing early and won't open up. The whole thing's like, just wait. Can't this society put on a pause for 3 weeks to get through an obvious, terrible outbreak, terrible wave, maximizing out, and come up with some basic safety net to say 3 weeks we'll be in better shape to go back. We got to go back. We're not.
Wait a second. By the way, you said Kansas society. Is that the? I just want to be clear. Is that the same society where 41% of Republicans and 34% of the general public think violence is appropriate sometimes? Is that the same? Are those the same people you're talking about?
It is that society.
Okay,
I've decided they also have a new hero, by the way. I have to slip this in. Margie may not know this, but Jim Will, during the past week, Antonio Brown, football player for the – oh, you do know?
Yes.
Okay. For Tampa, stripped himself of his uniform, ran off the field, and said, I'm out of here. I'm not going to play for this team anymore. That's the Republican opponents. They're basically saying, I'm not playing on this team. I assume he's their role model. Liberty over team, liberty over community. That's what he did. He basically said, you know what? I'm not for this team. I'm for me. Bye. That's what we're talking about values-wise.
So, Art Kaplan, one little thing you said, and we got to go in a second, but I just want to make sure. So you think that...
What do you mean you got to go? I'm just waking up here.
that 2 or 3 weeks, Omicron, the worst of it may be past. We can be hopeful about that. Well, that's
if we shut
to.
Down the whole country, it's school system. I mean, that's not happening. So
no, we're not going to do that. We're going to muddle through.
We're going to muddle through. Okay,
some won't, and da 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 da. We can get again. Could we lay in a plan for the next round? Could we get the tests ready for the next round? I mean, I'm already.
You think there's
to
a next? And there is a next round.
I think there may be.
Okay.
Enjoy your nap, Art.
That's up. I guess that's good, and then that's bad. Okay, Arthur Kaplan, thank you so much.
Be well, Art.
Art Kaplan is the Dr. William Meffer Virginia Comley Mitty Chair at NYU School of Medicine, where he also directs the Division of Medical Ethics. We love talking to Art Kaplan. Coming up, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us for the Arts and Culture Roundup, what's going on all around town. He's next on 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brown and Marjorie Egan. Before we introduce our next guest, Marjorie, you and I were talking to Juliette Kayyem before about Sean Hannity and the January 6th panel. Here's what our favorite satirist, Andy Barrow, it's just the headline of his most recent piece.
Yeah.
Sean Hannity informs January 6th panel that swearing to tell the truth would violate his contract with Fox. So there, there you go. In any case, joining us, I believe, from our studio. How pathetic is this? Well, we're both at home. To go over the arts and culture events happening around Boston is GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen. Am I right, Jared? Are you in our studio?
Yeah, and I can answer that question. It's very pathetic. I pulled in. Wait, where are their cars? I'm here all by myself.
Sorry, Jared.
But you know, you got things to do, Jared. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you got such great stuff this week. Let's start because you know I love all these celebrity pictures with what's going on up in Worcester with the love stories. This sounds and looks. I saw this on your show. It looks fantastic.
This is a really, really great show, I think, especially for right now, because it is a story just about love in all its forms. Love among artists, a love among subject and artist couples that we know. Marjorie, I think you're referencing some of them. Some of it is love among the ruins, like Elizabeth Taylor.
Exactly.
And Richard Burton and Mick Jagger and Jerry Hall, some of the ones that came undone.
Ringo Starr's wedding, that was pretty cool, right? Elizabeth Barrett Browning and Robert Browning, their hands and wine.
They're clasped hands.
Right?
It's beautiful.
Yes.
So, and the reason people might have gleaned already that there's a British bent to this, and it's because these all come from the National Portrait Gallery in London. And it's undergoing a $47 million restoration right now, which means a lot of its works that would never leave England can go out on tour. So the international tour has launched right here at the Worcester Art Museum. And so it's called Love Stories from the National Portrait Gallery London. And you see all manner of love, just as we've talked about. And Marjorie, that was actually one of the most touching ones to me, too, is the bronze clasped hands of Robert Browning and Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who, of course, wrote How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Ways.
Count the Ways, that's right.
And so you see her tiny little hand clasped by his. But you see love among the Bruins, as I said, you see a sleeping David Beckham.
David Beckham. Oh, gosh. Hold on. Stop right there. That was
Don't
great.
Don't say what you're going to say, no, how good-looking he is. I know that's
well,
what you're going
to
say.
Well, we all know he's good-looking. But the idea of the curator you spoke with, she talked about, so this here's David Beckham sleeping, and he's moving. And you can, like, imagine yourself being next to David Beckham. She said that, not me, Jim, in sleeping beside him. That was what she said. Was it not, Jared?
You'd have to bend like Beckham, though, to do it, wouldn't you?
Exactly.
No, that's never been used before, by the way, in a similar circumstance.
But it does. It's this video that gives you, and apparently, I forget how long it is, but you can just sit there and watch a David Beckham sleeping in his bed and kind of turning every now and again, but it suggests this intimacy. So it's one of the most modern love portraits that we have, well, aside from the royal family.
The royal family,
which
of
gets
course.
Its own section. You have Harry and Meghan, of course, but juxtaposed
Andrew
with that.
Andrew and Epstein, that's another yeah. love story.
Ugh,
oh,
yeah. Exactly. That's going to be interesting.
You're
to
ruining the mood here.
Sorry.
Well, I was about to ruin it anyway, because juxtaposed is seeing Princess Diana and Prince Charles
yeah.
together. So it's a good pairing, because you realize what this whole image and notion of a fairy tale really is. And of course, it's a facade to some degree. Many people have their own images of what Harry and Meghan are and what they represent. But you see what came before and what publicity and press and scrutiny does to a couple in Diana and Charles. But again, going back through all the way to the 1700s, you see great portraits of love, including a threesome in the 1700s.
Yes.
We have Emma Hamilton
yes.
married to Lord Hamilton until Lord Nelson, the dashing naval guy, comes onto the scene, and Lord Hamilton doesn't really want to give up her, so they all end up living together. So we all think that we're the most progressive society. We're breaking all the societal norms and mores. That didn't happen just now. It happened in the 1700s, and all of London was aware of it, and it was captured in portraits.
That's
it's the most
right.
animated Marjorie's been in.
Ménage à trois. Well, I'm going to be animated again now, because the other thing that really knocked my socks off was up in Salem.
Oh, this is great.
This was incredible. Dozens of these murals, the Punto Urban Art Museum.
Yeah, this is a great, great project. Also really good for right now, when so many people might feel uncomfortable going indoors. You can experience this out of doors. And this is different than any other mural project that I've seen around the country or the world.
Sure
as
is.
We've seen neighborhoods decide that they can perhaps add a new element, a new dimension, revitalize through murals. But often what you see, and I'll say this quite cynically, I noticed this at the Wynwood Design District in Miami, where a neighborhood became emblazoned with murals. All of the artists who lived there, the people who lived there, were kind of forced out as it was heavily gentrified, and it's now populated by high-end luxury stores.
Oh.
But this is not the case for the Punto Urban Art Museum, which is in the Point neighborhood of Salem, a neighborhood that does not get a lot of attention. You think of Salem, you think of witches and its history, and that's where the tourist guides send you, is to that history. That's what everybody talks about. But within seeing distance of downtown Salem is this neighborhood, and the North Shore Community Development Coalition, which has been in existence since the 1970s in terms of managing the housing, the affordable housing in this neighborhood. A few years ago, they decided, you know, let's try something different to just bring pride to this neighborhood. And so they started creating murals on a lot of the walls. It feels like all of the walls as you start to walk through this neighborhood. And they did it differently, though, because they got the public's input in what should go up. They had artists meet with the neighbors. Sometimes you have people of Salem or in nearby surrounding communities creating murals. They have annual curated exhibitions. This year's looks at the American, or I should say 2021, looked at the American Dream and different variations of that. And so this is not so that they can turn around these buildings and sell them and draw in new clientele. This is to just bring pride to the neighborhood, and it absolutely has done that, which is why I just love this project in particular.
Well, I thought what was so incredible is that, you know, you do see a lot of murals. We have a couple in Boston, but they're usually on the side of some big building. This one, you had that one, I don't know if it was actually a triple-decker, almost like a duplex, with the red and all the flowers all over it. The whole building in front of it was beautifully colored. And then one with an old man's face and one with the, I mean, it's very different than usual, right?
It is.
People's
different.
Homes are muraled.
Yeah, because you get this because people have come together, because they've talked, because there's just a generosity about it and there's a joy about it. That's what I found so wonderful. And one of the most, I think, poignant things to me is, again, this speaks to the power of the arts. This is why I love covering the arts. But I spoke with an artist, Yenny Hernandez, there, and her work is featured on two murals. She co-created one with the artist Anna Dugan, and she also had one as part of the American Dream Project. And I asked her, because she told me that she had grown up in low, affordable housing herself, and I asked her what difference it might have made had she seen this, and she said it would probably have made a tremendous difference to recognize the power of art at an early age, or to recognize that something like this was possible.
Yeah.
So this is a relatively new project just within the last few years. However, I think it's going to have fabulous long-term effects for the people who grew up in this community and the people who visit. You can go to the Urban Art Museum, the Indoor Museum, you can get a guide, and then you can just walk through and stroll and learn all about the works and the artists.
We're talking to Jared Bowen, who's in our studio at GBH, while Margie and I are in our bedrooms lying
That's
down
right.
or whatever we're doing. So I'm always glad when Van Gogh is on our list to discuss with you, because there's actually an artist that I can identify the work of, which makes me feel like I'm part of the conversation. I know there are a couple of exhibits. The one that I don't mean this to in any way, whatever. The one that really intrigues me is this thing at the SOA power station. Could you describe what's going on there, and then we'll get to the other one?
So what has happened here is Van Gogh has been dead for so long that his works are now in the public domain. So what has happened is you've seen the series of art installations, immersive, as they're described, art installations of Van Gogh start traveling the world. The one I saw is the one that's at the SOA power station. If anybody's gone to the South End neighborhood, it's where the SOA market is.
Yeah.
This 100 years ago, this was a power station that fueled the subway line, and it sat vacant for a really long time, but now it's being repurposed for events and exhibitions just like this. But you walk in, and you learn a bit about Van Gogh, which is that basically he was somebody who in the last couple of years of his life, as has been well told and documented, was somebody who suffered from ill health. So he moved to the south of France, and that's where he produced the bulk of his painting. There was just something about the light and the landscape, the flowers. We see his bedroom. We know the self-portraits that he did there, but he just flourished in that landscape. And so in this particular Imagine Van Gogh exhibition, we walk into these towering screens. There are about 20 of them, and elements of Van Gogh paintings are projected via about 57 HD projectors, and it's all accompanied to a soundtrack of classical music. So you just wind your way around the exhibition. So Van Gogh painting is on the floor, it's on the walls, it's just it envelops you as you walk through. And what they've done in this particular piece, I haven't seen the other one, is that they don't present them as you would see them at a museum. It's not the straight canvas, but they choose to feature elements of his painting, faces rather than full figures, and flowers rather than full fields. But what that does is it gives you a great sense of how he painted. When
like
they
all
bring
the brush strokes and everything,
right?
The
brush strokes are amazing. You see that this is not a term that I use. This is a term I heard years ago from a curator about Rembrandt, actually, but about how he basically sculpts in paint, just these gobs of paint that become these swirls that then become these fanciful, masterful works that, of course, we now can easily identify Van Gogh with. But that's what you find in this exhibition.
Well, that's great. And what's the other one?
The other one, it's a similar title, but it is has been at the Strand Theater in Dorchester.
Two Van Gogh things happening in town at the same time. We're talking to Jared Bowen.
So I feel so terrible for these people in the theater because they're still doing, out of necessity because of the pandemic, virtual productions. There's one that you highlighted, Jared, called Witness in Needham. Tell us about it.
Yeah, and I have to say this is a tough time, especially if you're looking to get tickets. I can tell you that literally as we speak, there are theater companies meeting to talk about productions they have this winter, maybe opening this month or early February, that are likely going to be postponed. Some have already announced their postponements because it's too uncomfortable for the theater community, for actors to be unmasked in rooms. And we know that audiences are starting to become increasingly reluctant to go to his faces too. So it's just kind of a reminder to check tickets, check websites before you go to anything. So we are going to live in the virtual realm longer. But one great entry here is once again by Arlequin Players Theater, who has just done such great innovative work during the pandemic in figuring out how they can marry live performance to the virtual realm. And that's not simply filming things on stage, but creating animation and interactive elements for the audience members. So their latest project is Witness. And it takes us to the real-life St. Louis, a ship which left Hamburg in 1939 with more than 900 Jewish people on board. It was bound for Cuba. When it left, it was really a vessel for hope because the Jewish people in Germany had experienced so much even at that point. Certainly knew it was coming, certainly knew the anti-Semitism that was – the violence that was pervasive. And they thought they were going to better lives. I won't spoil the ending by saying what happens when they got there, but we as the audience members are kind of on board with them. And so because it's a vessel of hope essentially at the beginning, we find this well-appointed ship with shops and cinemas and elevators or concerts and dinners and dances, and we meet some of the real-life figures who are on board. And again, you can click as you're watching them to learn more about them as you're watching them. But we see a talent show and a finger skating performance that happens, which is really a metaphor for Kristallnacht and homes shattered that night. We find another man who is literally building a house of cards. Again, another metaphor for the family that he's been forced to leave behind, who want him to go on to a better life. But then as this piece moves on, we realize that this is a ship of all space and time because it starts to introduce the stories of individuals who've been part of the second and successive waves of Jews fleeing their countries as anti-Semitism has taken hold in their neighborhoods and their lives. And then in its second and final acts, we are really confronted with what's still happening today, the 2018 Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, the stabbing of a rabbi here in Boston this past summer, and how this continues and the legacy that they were trying to flee 80 years ago is still very much in play.
Before you leave this, before you got into this this witness, you talked about how a number of productions that are about to open or about to open soon are deciding to shut down or postpone. I guess in New York. How widespread is this? I mean, it's sort of the unfortunate irony is you would tell us that one of the few venues that reopened not too long ago where they were requiring vaccination mandates, even though the city hadn't at that point, were theaters in and around Boston. Is that obviously didn't do the trick for them?
It hasn't, and I think for a number of reasons. I think financial. I've spent a lot of time on this morning, actually, talking to theater companies and figuring out what's happened, what's changed, and a lot of it does involve the artistic community and just not feeling safe, but knowing audiences were reluctant in the fall and are probably very, very reluctant right now. I think because things are escalating so quickly, people don't know how they can meet this moment, and so where they can, they're pushing things off. I mean, that's the fortunate thing that I'm hearing so far is that shows aren't necessarily being canceled. They're just finding, hopefully, they can present them in early to mid-February. But even museums, the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem is remaining closed until January 15th, so it's happening in that sector. I think it's the only museum I'm aware of. The ICA has closed for staff appreciation through this week. But, to me...
When you say staff appreciation, do you mean just giving them a week off?
I think so. That's what they've said on their website. Yeah. I didn't have a chance to speak with them. But, the way I spent all of this morning and basically until I walked into the studio was exactly how I spent, March 15th, 16th, 2020, when things just started flooding my way, announcements of cancellations and awareness. It's just so incomprehensible that we're here again.
Before you go for a second, is that unlike theaters with live performances, which you were telling us the vast majority voluntarily were doing vaccination mandates, most movie theaters, except for the Brattle and the Coolidge Corner and whatever, were not. Obviously that's going to change, at least in Boston, on January 15th. But you read things like Spider-Man is setting like all-time records. I think wasn't its opening like internationally, the fourth highest gross of any film ever, not just, during the pandemic. So are people going to movie theaters as far as, even the ones that don't require a vax mandate yet?
I think they are. And this is the perplexing thing about all of this. I think all three of us think of the restaurants we've been in over the last 2 years and the measures of safety we've found, even though we take all the precautions. So, people are trying to live life the best they can. And you know, certainly I want to see movie theaters thrive, too. We don't want to see that go away. It's everything is a decision. Everything is a decision with a consequence, and that's what we're all weighing now.
You know, before so you go, could you do me a favor? Since you're in your studio, can you make sure you tidy up before you leave? Is that
no? Okay. After you tidy up, you know, Jared Bowen, I have another question, or actually, it may take you a while to tidy up because things are pretty messy in there, Jared.
Some coffee stains here. There's a lot of caffeination going on in this studio.
A lot of caffeination. That is true. But you think if assuming we are past this Omicron thing in 2 or 3 weeks, that things can get back to at least semi-normal in February and March?
That's what I'm hoping for. I just, it's too bleak to think otherwise. But I think because we have such high vaccination rates here in Massachusetts and the importance of getting boosted, that most people have been safe. I think this is the other element. I haven't talked to you guys in a while, but I know a number of people now who've had COVID. I didn't know that until... I hadn't experienced that until I feel just last month or so.
Yeah.
Fortunately, most of them are surviving very well because of vaccinations and being boosted. So it gives me hope that this rises up, it falls like it has, as we've seen in South Africa and the UK, and then we can try to figure out life again and get back out and participate in life again.
Jared, good to see you. Great stuff this week. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you both.
Jared Bowen is GBH Executive Arts Editor. Coming up, we're going to talk about what we just talked about with Jared some and open the lines to you guys. Boston's vaccine mandate for entertainment venues goes into effect this month. While museums have banded together to instill almost uniform vaccine requirements, movie theaters and some other performance venues have not across the city. We're going to talk to you about whether the mandate will be enough to bring people back, or is Omicron keeping you at home, or have you decided to throw caution to the wind and get out there and live your life? The number is 877-301-8970. The email is bpr@wgbh.org. You're listening to Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Mark Regan and Jim Browdy. Boston's vaccine mandate goes into effect a little later this month, actually 10 days from today. Yes, 10 days from today, which will force all entertainment venues and movie theaters, among other public venues like restaurants and gyms, to require proof of vaccination. Would this be enough to convince you to go back to the movies? Jared says people are going already. Have you been going? Or will the specter of Omicron prove too much for you? And Marjorie, you know what I realize? Let's broaden this discussion because, you know, you and I have been making the case to anybody who can hear it that a vaccine mandate would help a business, not hurt a business. So let's talk, at least in Boston, when all these places are going to be where vaccinations are going to mandate. Are you going to go to a restaurant that you wouldn't otherwise go to? Are you going to go to movies if you weren't going to go? Or, as I said, are you doing it already because you want to live your life? 877-301 8970. So, how about a movie? You going to go after January 15th in Boston? You haven't been, have you?
To the movies?
Yeah.
No.
Even though a great theater near you, obviously, the Coolidge, has been requiring vaccinations. But you've decided too many people. Is that the deal?
I hate to say this. I've been watching so many movies on TV. I haven't gone to them to see them. I want to see West Side Story. I hear West Side Story is doing horribly, though, which is surprising because it got great reviews. But I want to go see that. I'm not surprised that Spider-Man has done really well because I think, generally speaking, that's a younger person's movie. But I do know friends of mine that did go see movies have said the movie theaters are pretty sparsely attended, so they didn't feel nervous because they were sitting in an entire big movie theater with maybe 25 people in there, so they weren't nervous about it. But I think the thing that we talked about before, and I've mentioned this before, I think because people who are vaccinated and boosted are getting Omicron but are not getting that sick has been a boost, oddly, to people's attitudes toward this virus.
It's odd. I think it makes sense. I agree.
Yeah, that if you think, and particularly this is among younger people that are not that worried about it because they're young and they're healthy, that they are going to go out, particularly kids in their 20s that want to go out and go to bars and they want to go to concerts and they want to go out and do these things. They're wearing their masks and they're going to be cautious, but if they get it, they're not going to get that sick. And so I think that's the good thing about this Omicron. It's very contagious, but it doesn't make you very sick, provided you are vaccinated.
877-301-8970. So our original focus off Jared was to talk about whether or not you're going to return to the movies, because the vast majority of theaters, unlike, again, the Brattle and the Coolidge Corner, have not required vax mandates. You're going to go back when Boston starts requiring them on the 15th. But let's go beyond that. If you haven't been to restaurants, you're going to start going to restaurants, because vaccination mandates are going to be uniform around the city. I think it's great, and we both, I was going to say we're staking our reputation on it. We are. Such as it is. Our position has been it's going to help businesses. We'll see if you agree. 877-301-8970. I have to say, I'd go to a movie, probably not on a Saturday night where it's likely to be packed.
Yep.
I'd go to, like, I really want to see West Side Story, too. Everybody says this version, Spielberg's version, is brilliant, and it apparently is very poorly attended. I don't know why that is. I'd go to that during the week or something. I don't know if I'd go on a Saturday night in a packed theater with 1,000 people. But mm-hmm. with the vaccine mandate, I would...
But you've gone to restaurants.
I have gone to restaurants. The vast majority of restaurants, almost without exception, have vaccination mandates. There are not many of them. There are about to be a lot more of them. They're almost always there's a vaccination mandate. Jim in a car, welcome to the show. Hi.
Yeah, Jim. Hi. This is Tim. It's Tim, actually.
That's why I said hi, Jim.
What I'm doing... Jim.
Yep.
So what I'm doing right now is I'm dying buying four seats. I don't go at the discounted time, which is when nobody's going to be there. I buy four seats in the back for my friend and myself, and we watch the movie, and nobody can breathe down on us. It seems to work out pretty well.
You're a genius, and I'm not kidding. I don't know if
back
I know
row.
Your name. That is a brilliant idea. Yeah. If you can afford it, that is a brilliant idea. Jim, thank you for the call. You essentially buy the space around you, and you sit in the back row.
Well, some of these theaters have those new, you know, the recline seats that are pretty huge, and you can be pretty far from people.
You know that I went to one of those. I told you this when I went to the media premiere for The Irishman, because I was about to have the, you know, Jack Goldsmith, who's famous lawyer, who's the head of the Office of Legal Counsel. His father actually was one of the people accused of being involved in the murder of Jimmy Hoffa. And I fell asleep because it was so relaxing in one of those chairs. And I didn't know that I had turned the heater on.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. And I woke up. I was like fried. Liz in Maine. But, boy, is that comfortable.
It yeah, they're great.
Unbelievable. Liz in Maine, welcome.
Hi, guys. Hi. So I am definitely not ready to go back to the movies. Mm-hmm. I am not ready to sit in a large auditorium with unmasked people munching away on popcorn and God knows if they're vaccinated or not. So I wait for it to come out on demand, and I will gladly pay that higher rental fee early on when it is available on demand, because I figure I'd pay that at the theater anyway. But I thought of a meme that I had seen somewhere along the line on Facebook, and it basically was saying that, you know, Congress had gotten together and discussed mandatory masking, vaccinations, and shutdowns, and decided that it wasn't a good return on their investment. And that's kind of, you know, I kind of feel like what Art was saying, if we just shut everything down for a couple of weeks and got ahead of this thing, I think we'd be in a much different place. But
well, we're not,
you know,
doing
it's not a good return on the investment.
We can't even get mask mandates, so I don't think that's that. Liz, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. And speaking of Congress, you know what I meant to mention to you?
Yeah.
Did you a story we had today, I guess for Juliet, had a photograph, I think it's from Politico, of the January 6th committee in session.
Yeah.
Every single member of the committee, except Chairman Thompson, was not wearing a mask.
I noticed that, yeah.
And they were sitting shoulder to shoulder. Like, I didn't understand that at all. In any case, 877-301-8970. Let's go out to Brookline, where Rich is on the phone. Hello there, Rich.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
How's it going?
Good.
Excellent. So my wife is in the entertainment industry. She's an independent attorney. We see every film ever released practically, whether we stream it or we go live. Yeah. And we're both vaccinated and boosted. We're both very careful. We wear cloth masks and often additional KN95s on top of it. We also consume lots of the science that's put out there. And we basically have decided that you know, it seems like everybody's going to wind up getting this at some point. And so being vaccinated and boosted, we're not all that concerned that if we do get it, we're going to get more than a mild case, understanding that mild still seems pretty crappy when you read the report.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's
but
true.
It's not going to be as serious as when my wife had COVID early on, which also was reasonably mild, but she did have some symptoms. But anyway, the movie theaters typically that we've been to, we have been to about five movies in person in the last few months, and they're not packed to the gills. People are generally pretty careful, and, you know, we just feel you got to get on with your life, and I guess we feel lucky because we're not seriously immunocompromised, mm-hmm. so we do are willing to take the risk.
You know, before you go ahead, but so you're going to theaters, Rich, you and your wife are going to theaters where there was not a, unless you were only going to places like the Coolidge and the Brattle. You were going to theaters where there wasn't even a vaccination mandate, and you were comfortable because of your vaccination status and your mask and whatever.
Yeah, a few months ago, the theaters were barely attended when you went to a film. So it's definitely a lot more people in the theater now, and you know you do feel a little nervous, but you know. Like I said, we're not immunocompromised. We're not.
Yep.
We kind of figure, based on everything we're hearing, like we're all going to get this at some point.
I want to be like you when I grow up. Rich, that's great.
Well,
keep enjoying them. Thanks for the call.
You're hearing more and more people say that.
I know
mean,
that.
We're going into year number three. You vaccinated. You're boosted. You're not going to get that sick from this. I hope, you know, this other variant out of France that people are talking about is going to be the same kind of thing, that you're not going to get that sick. But and especially, like I said, if you're you know, 18, 20, 25, I mean, your life is a lot about socializing. And I think those people who are, generally speaking, not going to get very sick at all, I mean,
But can I tell you something? I agree with that, but I almost have a totally different perspective than yours on this. You keep mentioning the younger people, and I agree with every word you're mm-hmm. saying. However, they got a lot of time to go to the movies. They got a lot of time to go to a restaurant.
Right.
Older people have a lot less time to go to the restaurant and the movies.
That's right. Better go fast, Jim. You could be dead.
No, I'm serious. I mean, and obviously they're a lot less safe by definition. We know that. But you would think those are the ones who want to fill their time with joy and fun and things that make them happy, as opposed to those who can be more relaxed in terms of their enjoyment. You understand what I mean?
No. Older people, who wants to fill themselves with joy and love?
Older people, because they don't have as much time as a 27-year-old.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think older people are more worried about getting sick because they are older.
I know that.
So, I mean,
in any case,
Jim, it's tough to get old. You know what I mean?
I wouldn't know. So let me ask you something. When Rich just used the expression that I'm sure each of us have used 10 million times, for the first time ever, it occurred to me, what does packed to the gills mean? I just looked it up. Do you know what it means?
I assume it has something to do with fish.
Yeah, but what you could actually figure this out. I'm embarrassed that I didn't.
In a boat, and when you're coming back, you got to pack the fish with ice?
No, when you're cooking it or preparing it and you mm-hmm. stuff it fully, like with things like onions and tomatoes, to the gills. So
Thank you, Jim.
You're not that interested, apparently. Okay.
I'm never going to be cooking a fish this whole. I just want to let you know about that.
But when you're older, you got to answer those questions fast, is my point, by the way, because you have a lot less time to do it.
Roger from New Hampshire.
Hey, Roger.
Thank you for calling.
What's up?
Well, thank you, guys. I'm 64, and believe me, going to the movies is not on my bucket list.
Yeah.
However, we both went, we gave ourselves a Christmas gift a couple of nights in Portland, Maine. Portland does not mandate masks.
I know that.
We did go to the Nickelodeon. The first movie we saw was West Side Story. It was brilliant. It was terrific to see it on the big screen.
Oh, wait.
When we sat down, we went in masked. We looked around. There was a couple behind us. People were, you know, choosing seats in a socially distanced way. But, you know, we looked around, make sure people were masks. And, you know, you can fill your mask with popcorn and eat it like that.
Boy, you are so my kind of guy, Roger. That is brilliant.
It says in the screen you saw licorice pizza, too. What did you think of it? People said that's great.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah, I want to see that, too.
You go to movies to feel good and... Mm-hmm. And I remember the 80s, you know, and it was terrific.
Okay.
You know, Roger, let me tell you something. I now can't wait to go to the movies so I can stuff my KF94
popcorn. Yeah, think about that. It might get a little greasy, but, you know, do you want the butter popcorn if you're stuffing it or not? I'm not sure.
You can put a little sausage in there, too. You can shove everything in that thing, you know? It's incredible.
Right. You can have a whole hoagie, Jim.
What a brilliant idea. No one knows what a hoagie is listening to the show.
It's a sub you only sandwich know what if you're from...
What's that?
Sub sandwich if you're from Philadelphia.
It's a sub. That's what
yeah.
we call it in Philly.
Yeah, I spent
that's
some
right.
time
Roger, thanks for the call. 877-301-8097. You know what? I can't believe you and I haven't talked about this
what?
A lot. January, if you and I are right about vaccine mandates,
mm-hmm.
the whole city is going to change on January 15th. Two things are going to happen. One, the vaccine mandate goes into place
right.
for all those facilities we talked yep. about. And two, if the experts are right, Omicron's supposed to peak mid-month, actually
right.
a couple of days earlier
yep.
than that.
Yep.
So it's going to begin to be on the downward slide.
Mm-hmm.
You know that if you're going to a place, they're going to check your vaccination.
Yep.
That's sort of an up note after a really down 3 hours on the radio, don't you think?
I think people are going to be very excited about getting out.
You don't
out.
Sound
I think,
persuaded.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen with this next variant. I don't know if it's going to be more virulent than this one. I don't know. But, yeah, I think that listen, everybody is sick of this, right? You just want to get out and you just want things to go back to normal. I used to say this before we had the vaccine, you know, I never spent a lot of time sitting at bars. I mean, I like to go out for restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I generally didn't go out and sit
I
at
love
a bar.
Sitting at bars.
All I want to do for weeks and weeks and weeks is go sit at a bar. I want to go sit at a bar again and not have to worry about how far away somebody is from me and whether I have to put my mask on every 2 seconds when the person comes back to like,
but
you know.
But, you know, if this what? Doesn't work out, you can always watch West Side Story on your phone. I mean, I think that's the way Spielberg intended it.
Margo in New Hampshire, what do you think?
Hey, Margo, what's going on?
Hi, you guys.
Hi.
So I was feeling really comfortable over the summer,
mm-hmm.
But with Omicron and I just winter, I'm not going anywhere with a big group of people. I don't feel comfortable, and I have to say though, I'm not sure it's just at this point conditioning. Like I just am I ever going to feel comfortable around, you know, a big group of people? I was waiting in line at the grocery store this weekend, and it was really crowded, and I got very uncomfortable and kind of anxious. And, you know, I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted. I still just don't want to get this. My coworker got it over the holidays and she was boosted, vaccinated, the whole thing, and is pretty careful with her mask. And she got it and she's been very sick. So I just don't want to get COVID. And I don't see myself taking a chance on movie theaters, definitely, anytime in the near future.
You know, you also touched on a point that I haven't really thought about a lot. I know you weren't going quite this far, but I'll go a step further. Is, you know, how long does it take for most of us to shed this careful way in which we're living? You know, people like Marjorie keep talking about, a lot of people saying, I got to live my life. When you live your life a certain way, for 2 years in a row with great rigidity, you can't just shed that thing.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it, Margo, and Margo's talking about it, everyone's idea of how much risk
you're
they
right.
can...
is different.
Exactly.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, Margo, you're probably more going to dive off a cliff in, the coast of the Amalfi Coast or something, I would expect, either. Right? I mean,
and
everybody...
And I did feel... Exactly. But this summer, I did feel like I went without my mask a lot this
yeah.
summer, you know, and I felt really comfortable and I was vaccinated, and you get a little bit, you know, complacent about it at
yeah.
that point.
Yeah.
But this variant right now seems extremely contagious, and people who are sick, it's not that, you know, yeah, I get it. They're not dying and they're getting over it. But I'm watching a friend who's very sick.
I totally
agree.
I don't have time to be that sick, basically.
Yeah.
So I don't feel like it's worth the chance at this point.
Margo, we got it. Thank you. You expressed it well. You know what I was thinking, again, the larger
risk assessment. I see you as a big risk taker, Jim.
That's a very fun. It's funny.
I see you as a let me jump out of the airplane kind of guy. Am I wrong?
Marjorie, because Marjorie knows in a 65 mile an hour area, I drive 65
That's
miles
right.
an hour. That's
Jim. Jim drives like a great grandmother. Let's not go over 55 on the Mass Bike. We just don't want to do it.
No,
you know?
The speed limit is 60. I'll go 60. That's
okay.
My deal. Where are you going?
Abby in Newton. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Abby.
Hi. I was calling offering a different perspective. I work in a restaurant. I plan events. So I just went back to work in the past month. It's been a really tough kind of go of it, just with the new variant coming around. Hard to book parties. My restaurant is in Cambridge. So technically we are not obviously part of the city of Boston, but we are going to require proof of COVID vaccination.
Okay.
So
what's the name of the place?
Coming. I actually would rather not say right now because finish the story, you'll understand why.
Okay,
this might not last long for me. But anyway, I had a party booked on the 15th, so I reached out and said, just as a reminder, you need to bring proof of COVID vaccination. And he wrote back to me, I'm not vaccinated and I've already had COVID. Most of the people in my group are in the same boat. How strict is the policy? And I looked at my computer screen and I was like, why did I even come back to doing this? Like, we're in Cambridge. I thought for sure the first person that I said, okay, you need to provide proof of vaccination, they'd be like, right, I have it laminated, we're ready to go. And instead, I then had to call, you know, our director of operations and make sure, is this what we're doing? What kind of legal clauses do I now need to add to my contracts to make sure people understand this? I mean, I'm kind of glad he's not coming.
So am I. And Abby, I think you're doing the right thing. And can I selfishly ask you to stay in line and tell our producer what restaurant you work at so I can patronize it?
I sure will. Thanks. I might not be there anymore, but I will.
Well, I hope you are. Abby, thank you for the call. I hope those are the outliers. I hope people are going to respect these mandates. They're not coming to Cambridge, as far as I know, imminently, but I hope they do.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know why you want to inflict yourself on other people if you're going to take that position. You know what I mean?
Because there are a lot of you-know-whats in this world, Mark.
Oh, okay. All right.
I used to be one.
Used to be one, he says. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Keep us, if you want to listen to us 24/7, we have a podcast called Boston Public Radio. Of course, tomorrow we're going to be joined by a psychologist who'll talk about how to break the cycle of radicalization that you've seen, particularly for people that are living in this kind of alternate universe. We're all going to have a congressman on the air.
Catherine Clark's joining us.
Catherine Clark, who's a big deal down in D.C., she's going to join us as well. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas, Rebecca Tauber, and additional support provided by Preeti TK. Jim, what's on TV? Oh, and John the Clark Parker, of course, is our engineer. What's on TV, Jim?
Two things are on TV tonight. One, we're going to talk to two of the Globe reporters who did this fabulous piece on the Brigham's failed effort to open a hospital for billionaires over there in China. It is an appalling story.
What a mess.
It's a great story and appalling. By the way, a nonprofit organization using your tax dollars to serve billionaires in China.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful thing. And secondly, you're going to love this segment. There are two pretty competent legal talent people who are going to debate whether Trump is indictable. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge. Michael Sullivan, former U.S. attorney in Massachusetts.
Oh, great.
Nominated by George W. Bush. So I think we'll have an interesting discussion about what the future holds for the former president of the United States.
That sounds excellent. I hope you're feeling better, Jim. You had a tough day. I know. I'm
so
Marjorie Egan.
Tomorrow will be much more upbeat. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Jim Brody.
And have a great day, and hope you can tune in again tomorrow.
Bye.